Thank you, everyone. We will call the hearing back into session. Do we have members of the committee on the phone? All right, thank you. We'll jump in with the Department of Environmental Services. Please introduce yourselves to the record and start the presentation.
I will, thank you. I'm assuming everybody can hear me okay. My name is Bob Stout. I'm Commissioner of the Department of Environmental Services, and I have with me our Chief Operating Officer, Susan Carlson. She's here to answer the hard question. So with that, I'll start. So you all have PowerPoint handouts. Hopefully you have it. I can see the people here looking at it currently. I want to point out I do have the division directors on the phone. If there's any need, we can pull them in also. Some of these slides I'm going to breeze through, and frankly, Matt, they were kind of for your edification, kind of to orient you. But
thank you, Commissioner.
You're welcome. So slide two really is our organizational chart. We have three main divisions, and then almost a fourth division, our commissioner's office, where we handle department-wide issues. And the numbers on that chart represent our full-time permanent staffing. So again, I'm going to breeze through those pretty quickly so we can get to the numbers. Our mission statement's on page three, which is to protect the public health and the environment. Some of our core functions going to slide four. And again, obviously, please feel free to ask me questions at any point. Much of our work of late has evolved around water issues and water contamination issues, so I'll talk about that a little bit more as we dig in. And that's not to do a spoiler up front, but the small increases we have really relate to that. Slide five, again, is a little bit more detail on that. On infrastructure, just to make sure people understand the acronyms I'm using, the GWGTF is the Groundwater Drinking Water Trust Fund. I can certainly talk more about that if people have questions. GWSRF is the Drinking Water State Evolving Loan Fund. And CW Clean Water SRF is the Clean Water SRF State Evolving Loan Fund. When you see clean water, that's kind of a term of art for not drinking water, but wastewater, water runoff, that type of stormwater. So moving to slide six, some of our budget highlights. Obviously, we had an efficiency budget, which is roughly $2.54 million, or 3% of the state budget. We have 484 authorized full-time positions. Permanent positions. Just to give some context, as an agency, we annually do around 21,000 permits and over 16,000 inspections. We administer state law, but we also have delegation and co-regulation agreements with the federal government for some certain programs. Moving to slide seven, Sue Carlson. Did these slides, so thank her for that. She loves pie charts, so we're going to have some here. So the first slide is to give you an idea of the source of funding. As you see, about 9% is general funds. Nearly half of that is for state aid grants and communities, and I'll talk about that when we talk about prioritized needs. Leaving just 5% of the general fund operations, which is a little under $23 million. 23% of our sources of funding is from federal funds, just under $60 million. 68% is others, so to give you an idea of that, we have the state revolving loan repayment funds of just under $46 million, or 27%. The drinking water groundwater trust fund is another 22%. Waste fee programs are 31%. Water fee programs are 14%, air fee programs are 5%, the commissioner's office is 2%. I'm assuming that adds up close to 100. The state revolving loan programs, again, this is the money that goes out to the municipalities, accounts for about 35% of our overall budget. If you go to slide eight, this is to give you an idea of the use of the funds, get another pie chart. Again, our operating budget, about 25% of our operating budget is for salary and benefits. 9% is operating expenses, debt service, interagency transfers. That leaves about two-thirds of the budget, grant loans, contracts, and oil fund reimbursements. Loans is our largest category at 40%. Again, that's the state revolving loan program, both the drinking water and clean water programs, drinking water program or trust fund, and a new program, which is for PFAS loans. So I'll move to slide 9. That's our how our budget's broken up by division. As most of you are aware, our water division is our largest, both in terms of staff and budget. The water division is just under $133 million. Waste management comes in second, just over $102 million, or 40% of our operations. And then the air and commissioner's office take up the remaining 7%. So on slide 10, we have an analysis for you of by cost category. So what you see is that our budget grew by 6%, or about $14.2 million from fiscal year 21 to 22. The increase from 22 to 23 relates to salary and benefits, and I'll discuss all this in a second here. The 22 growth, the fiscal year 22 growth, is due primarily to the creation of the emerging contaminant program in the waste management program division. That's the PFAS issue. And that's, if you're interested, that's page 2762 on your book. For the 2021 biennium, we were granted to use $6 million of drinking water and groundwater trust funds. And as I'm sure you're aware of late, it was an appropriation for $50 million to be bonded for the creation of the PFAS loan program. Part of that program, again, that was in the House Bill 4 trailer bill, we added into our budget $50 million per year to the 22 and 23 operating budget for that program. At the same time, we increased the contract appropriation by $3.9 million. The increase in the grant form on this slide is due to the Drinking Water Groundwater Trust Fund grant class. That's an increase of $4.5 million. So we went from $10.5 to $15 million again as part of that bonding legislation. And we've offset smaller reductions in other grant programs. The operating expenses were increased by $1.4 million primarily as a result of a dam assessment grant, which is federal funds from the National Resource Conservation Service, and that's to fund engineering assessments and design work on state-owned flood control dams that were constructed by the NRCS. In particular, we're looking at three dams on the South Egan River watershed that have safety issues going on. That's the majority of that increase, all but $392,000. And then, as other agencies, I'm sure, have mentioned, our salary and budgets for 22 have increased by 3%, and this is shows a slight increase in salaries, but it's offset by a 9% increase in primary benefits, health insurance, and certainly the 20. Fiscal year 23, we see the 27th pay period, which again, I'm quite sure all the agencies have. The next slide on 11 is an analysis by funding category. Again, the general fund decreased by 12%, or $3.1 million, primarily due to reductions in salary and benefits, contracts, grants, and that decrease flows into the next year also. As mentioned, the Drinking Water Groundwater Trust Fund increased $4.5 million. All others in that category, somebody have a question? All others represent an increase in the emerging contaminants account, again, that's PFAS. For stages between 22 and 23, again, we're seeing the 27th pay period and a $425,000 for the oil fund board reimbursements. So starting on the flux regarding federal funds and what may become available, so we wanted to go over prioritized needs and explain our ask on that end. So I'll delve into slide 13. Our first priority is our solid waste management program. So again, we permit solid waste landfills and incinerator operations. We provide assistance to municipalities regarding recycling and composting. In order to obviously meet the budget general fund targets, we had to defund various positions. These were included in that. We, assuming availability of extra funds, but that's our priority. We'd like to see those two of those positions refunded. Is it refunded? Is that the right word? Funded, obviously, that. And again, I want to also note that there was a legislative study committee in the 2019 session, and they raised in their report an issue that there should be more staffing in the program, not less staffing. So this is a little bit in response to that as well. The next number two priority is for our program management units that reside in our commissioner's office. That's the only request we have that's for a new position for our prioritized needs, and that's to have a business system analyst to work on our one-stop redesign. So our one-stop, as we call it, is our collection of software programs that are our entry from both consultants, for the most part, and the public to look at our environmental data. As an example, the good news is we try very hard, and that's a good way to meet the fact that, if I remember correctly, the governor's comments this morning were, how can we, in the long term, be more efficient? So the good news is we're trying to get out their applications so people can get access to data more efficiently. The bad news is once you put that out there, if you don't maintain it, it causes a problem also, and there's a cost, continuing cost. So that's an area where efficient. Almost a year ago, we had a cybersecurity issue identified with our software. Some of the coding was so old that it created a vulnerability. We had been working with DOIT to bring the system down while they fixed that, which is appropriate. Again, good news, bad news, we were inundated with people calling us saying, when's the system going to be up? I really need this. So it really demonstrated the value of that. So that's why that's our number two priority to help work on those issues. Our number three priority, again, is back to the solid waste management program. Our fourth priority on this slide, number 13, is regarding our dam administration. So as you're aware, the state owns many dams, hundreds of dams, as well as the over 2,600 dams that are through the state. The properties that we own, many of them, we require the ability to be able to flood the land. So we own either easements or the land outright. And we have over 300 parcels of land that cover 9,500 acres. And releasing 40 camp lots, some of that's by statute, 110 waterfront parcels, and there's over 30 leases to the towns, in addition to other surveying requirements that we have. So that position was vacated due to the retirement, since it was vacated, and again, in order to meet our budget goals, we left that open. We would like to be able to, assuming funds being available, we'd like to be able to fill that also. On page 14 or slide 14, for our fifth priority is for our wetlands program. I talked a little bit about database work. There's a desire for our wetlands program to be able to develop a system to basically look at our, not only to serve the public, but look at what the environmental impacts are, both in terms of mitigation an impact on the environment. That was specifically cited as a deficiency in last year's legislative budget assistance performance audit, and we're trying to address that item. Item number six for our prioritized needs has to do with surplus maintenance or Superfund sites. As you're probably aware, Superfund sites, after the initial 10-year period, the site and therefore the cost of maintaining the site reverts to the state, and we have a fair number of those. So we have, this is really goes under deferred maintenance right now. We have for work at multiple sites in the state, the Keith site, the Kearsarge site, the Sandwell site. We were interested in being able to move ahead and do some needed work on those sites. Items 7, 8, and 9 are kind of similar in that they're important, but they're other people's money, so to speak. So item number 7 is DOIT has an allocation for software subscriptions, basically to go to Office 360 that are part of that. Department of Justice, again, we support the Environmental Bureau, has a similar allocation for Office 365 licenses. And then item number 9 is from Administrative Services. We pay an annual rent to occupy our main building on Hayden Drive, and they have defunded some of those efforts. It's on their prioritizing, it's my understanding, and this is not a portion of that for the Hayden Drive building. And lastly, on slide 15, again, I talked about CERCLA maintenance and Superfund sites. We have a need that, again, we put fairly low on our prioritized list to replace an SUV that we have to actually go to those sites and monitor those. And finally, I promise I've talked a little bit about this, is our 11th prioritized need is state aid grants for water wastewater systems. So I expect representatives are very familiar with this, but to summarize quickly, the state aid grant program is a after-the-fact program, so that the municipalities will do the work, get the facility running, and then depending on the legislature's desire and the strength of the government's budget, they get reimbursed for a certain percentage of that after the fact. So there's a list of 11 projects from eight towns, including 2 for Hooksett, 3 for Concord, 1 for Dover, 1 for Exeter, 1 for Newport, 1 for Nashua, 1 for Littleton, and 1 for Salem, and that's to fund those projects that are, again, to refund, if you will, the projects have already been done. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions, and again, I assume Carlton here, so I feel even happier about that. So.
Thank you, Commissioner. Just for a point of clarification, all of those wastewater projects were completed during a period where there was a moratorium on the state aid grant program. So these are not for projects that were completed while the state was still actively accepting applications. Is that correct?
I don't know if they all were.
There are 3 of them that were completed before the moratorium. We have no deadline on when towns can file for their what we call the SAG grant. So a few of them, like there's 2 in Hooksett that were finished in 2009, and they're just now applying for the SAG grant. But most of them have been completed by the 12/31/19 deadline that was in HB 4 that the legislature said that yes, there is a moratorium, but those projects that were substantially complete by the state could apply if there was a project.
Understood. Thank you.
Question. Commissioner, do you have any recent information about PFAS effects on human health?
We recently provided a letter to the legislature. One of the, I don't remember which round of statutes it was, PFAS required us to annually make recommendations to the legislature on the MCLs, the regional air standards. So we did do an evaluation, and our look right now in the case is, if I don't answer your question, make sure I do, indicates that we don't see a need to do anything different than we're already doing. So that included a look at the latest available studies.
Have any of these studies been done in New Hampshire?
Not that I'm aware of. Most of them were from academia, as I understand it. So I'm not aware of. I know there's some blood testing going on in Hampshire, but I'm not sure that is coming to full fruition as far as results and what does that mean and that type of thing. So most of these are academic and they're, to be blunt, they are not mostly based on direct human interaction. They're based on animal interaction.
Thank you.
Hello, Commissioner. This is the record. My name is Matthew Kalo. I've incoming such director. Looking at slide 13 for prioritized needs, you mentioned at least one of these positions is currently vacant. Is that true of all of these positions that appear in prioritized needs?
That's correct.
And a second question, Commissioner. Do you know offhand how many Superfund sites we have across the state?
I'm going to defer to my chief operating officer. I don't know that.
We have eight former Superfund sites that are 100% state control. I will have to get back to you on the number of actual active Superfund sites we have, but I think it's at least the same amount.
Thank you.
I think it's 11. I think this question came up at this hearing 2 years ago.
Did it? Give me better memory than that.
No one quote me on that, but 11 jumps out of my mind.
But I think that's a great question, because my experience is that people hear the word super fund and they think there's a super amount of funding available.
I have one final question. Relating to the percentage changes in the budget, I do want to note the department met the governor's target to reduce general fund, and the bottom line increases are a result of funding from both capital appropriations and federal grants, which have been made available. Because it is every other agency we've heard from today has had bottom line reduction in some capacity, and you're the first to come forward with a federal increase, but you did reduce your state funds per the governor's guidance.
Yes, that's correct.
More of a statement question. Anyone on the line?
If you have a question, please press 5 on the star.
All right. Thank you to the Department of Environmental Services.
Yeah, I apologize. I really didn't realize I had my earpiece in the whole time. It's just a normal part of life right now. I'm always on my phone.
Sorry, we thought you were a robot. No, never. We understand your priorities, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Give us a few necessary minutes and then. That program has not been the governor's top priority for the department. So that was.
No, I mean, it's that people who've been completed for 11 or 12 years.
there was the way the legislature chose the cutoff date in the last budget was time to get a
specific program. What's fascinating to me was just that.
Yes.
So everybody in the audience knows, I think you probably all know this, but because it's a public hearing, you can't start the next day to speak, like you can't get ahead of schedule. And so probably people sit there, I've known this myself before, and you're like, what the hell, let's go. And, but you got to wait, like, okay, we got to wait another 30 seconds or whatever. So, just in case anyone wants
to watch schedule.
Thank you for that, Trey. I did assume everyone knew why we were sitting here in silence.
Oh, they probably all do.
No.
When I talk mostly, it's to make myself feel better.
Well, you know. It does happen here, Max, because they come to find you, and the same thing happens. We're silent. We just sit and watch. Thank you.
I thought they were waiting to find out who's brave enough to come before us. Oh.
I think they should all be complimented on showing up early.
Yeah, amen.
Well, no, they should be complimented on short, precise, clear presentation. That's from early.
I'd like to call up in preparation for starting at 1:45 the office of the Professional Life Certification. Thank you, Director. Before you start, I'd like to just thank you for complying with the Governor's directive. The Office of Professional Licensure and Certification had the unenviable distinction of being the only agency 2 years ago to completely and wantonly disregard the Governor's budget instructions, which was never lost on either the Governor or the House of Representatives. So thank you for complying with the instructions that were provided to your department. I know that you were not in a position of leadership at that time, so this is no way a reflection on yourself, but thank you for, as everyone else, following the instructions.
Thank you. Happy to comply. Appreciate it. So, for the record, my name is Lindsay Corbin, the Executive Director of the Office of Professional Licensure and Certification. With me is our Business Administrator, Stephen Richard. I know Trish that she makes us with our Business Director is also aligning people to make your practices. And I certainly appreciate the opportunity to sit before you today to testify in support of our agency proposal. So I wanted to start off by giving you a little bit of an overview of what the agency is about, what our priorities are. It is a new agency, and I think our budget really reflects where we'd like to go. So our view now is that OPLC is the agency responsible for administering 54 board of council and commissions within the state of New Hampshire, as well as the prescription for our monitoring program. It is a new agency. It is a quite small agency with 67 permanent classified positions. However, the impact that we're going to see has on the state of New Hampshire is that if this fiscal year 20 alone, 223,423 occupational licenses in the country were active from the fiscal year. This figure represents a 29% increase from fiscal year 19 alone, and not accounting for non-residents, amounts to 16% of the country's population. Every person in the state of New Hampshire and in this room has interacted with the CLT or one of the state. So what is LIRC for this? And I think everyone knows that the issue licenses or should know the issue licenses and certifications and conduct investigations. And of course, the reason that we do that is to protect the public. The general court has concluded that we need to ensure that the individual minimum standards necessary to practice a particular occupation in a safe manner. And we've done that with occupational licensing. So we want to make sure that a physician has the appropriate education before they go out and conduct brain surgery. So that makes sense. But occupational licensing really is, by definition, a purposeful barrier to workforce. And it really plays a vital role in workforce. And I think we can all agree that at this stage, we really need to ensure that those workforce barriers are absolutely necessary in order to protect the public. We have a workforce shortage in addition. We have workforce shortages, particularly in healthcare field. So we need to make sure that the licensing requirements are narrowly tailored to ensure minimum standards are met, and that the licensing procedures are not so onerous that they themselves are a barrier to workforce. And this is really difficult to do if it's not possible if you have 54 different licensing boards ready to show and setting procedures and processes. So in 2016, of course, the general court established the social safety with two primary purposes that was set forth in our statute. It's really to promote the efficiency and economy of the administration of these schools while protecting the public. And so OPLC's objective is a little bit different from the board in that we assist the board with protecting the public while at the same time ensuring that licensing is efficient to allow for reduced workforce barriers. And we really take that seriously. From my perspective, based on my observations in the agency of last year, there really are two major unnecessary barriers to workforce as it pertains to licensing. It's really the time it takes to get a license and the time it takes for somebody to re-enter the workforce after completion is filed. And I can tell you, based on my personal observations and my experience, that we compete a lot with the neighboring states for the same workforce. We are not doing as good a job in terms of our licensing speed as other states, particularly Vermont, which is a struggle with that. We lose a lot of workforce for neighboring states. So really with that in mind, the OPLC's proposed budget was created with two primary goals in mind: to reduce the time frame for licensing and reduce the time frame for restoration. So we've been in this process, and the slide for we'll kind of walk you through how we are presently trying to achieve efficient agency operations. This fiscal year, we've embarked on a mission to really maximize efficiency using our existing resources. We've embarked on an agency reorganization project. Essentially, when OPLC was created, all the board and their staff were divided based on subject matter. What do they do? Do you pertain to health care in the previous division? If they pertain to death control or completely in that division? And all the staff that supported them pretty much did the same thing that they had been doing prior to the OPLC creation. So we have 54 different ways of sending out enrollment, 54 different types of paper to print enrollment from, 54 ways to conduct investigation. Obviously, that's incredibly inefficient. So we have embarked on a mission to reorganize the agency based on function. We perform two primary functions in the agency: investigations or enforcement, and licensing. We want to really create two divisions based on those functions so that we can utilize our staff across different forms. And I think that's going to be really efficient. We're in the process of doing that. We're already getting improvements, such as centralizing mail linking. We have 54 different ways of processing the mail, and multiple people, 20 people processing the mail every day. We've just centralized the finance. They're collecting customer service, and we have 11 license clerks, actually 16 board administrators, all perform the same function, which would interrupt our data. So we're creating a customer service bot and obviously adopting the same policies across the board. So we're also trying. long-term investment in technology is really going to exist, particularly with the licensing deal, moving licensing online. I want to thank the governor and then the council back in January when we were able to get that approval to create two temporary positions, DYC, DYC, that would be United and OPLC. It's really been a game changer for us. We just hired two individuals in the fall. And we now have a plan in place to transition all licensing online by the end of 2024 in that calendar year. We're also looking to improve communication. We are presently updating all the content on our website by the end of 2020. And I took what the governor said to heart and one of his phone calls in terms of going to your website and figure out how to just play around with your end user. And I could not figure out how to obtain a license. And that was scary. So that's probably yields to a lot of questions that we answer. So we are completely going through and revamping our website. That will be completed by the end of December. And then we're hoping for a website redesign working with the OIT next year. So then moving into our budget, right? Because I think all of your excellent priorities really set the stage for what we'd like to do. Slide one will just give you a simple using visuals of what the division looks like and what it looks like now. So we really in fiscal year 22 and 23 through this budget watched to achieve efficiency in accounting. And we do that in our elimination of the double accounting method. When I stepped down to do this budget, it was really hard for me to get a person that I've been person early. Okay, how much money do we actually have here? Because we were billing ourselves, and it really didn't make sense. And I thought public transparency is supposed to be not that we're bringing in. So we proposed to eliminate that. We also really need to eliminate the 50 votes for the board. Part of the purpose of OPLC is to really share resources. So a lot of our costs are between indirect costs that we need to allocate back to the board. And right now we are tracking expenses down to, the paperclip that was really a paperclip that was purchased for this particular staff member that I didn't want to spend this anyhow. Support for particular care. And that's inefficient. We can see that in our risk conversion to Chase. We want to accept credit cards through a terminal. We have to have 54 physical terminals. And that's really inefficient and ridiculous. So I think we need to move in a direction where we are counting based on our free division. Slide 6, this is really important, and the achieving efficiency in personnel. So OPLC up until, really up until now, but it looks a lot like in terms of our personnel, what the board had when they came over to us 4 or 5 years ago. We just got some staff and it was kind of plopped together and not really looked at from a strategic standpoint. And by virtue of that, 22% really of our workforce is part-time. And that in itself is a barrier to achieving efficiency because when we don't have a hiring freeze in place, we see this constant influx of people utilizing part-time positions as a mechanism to step into full-time state employment. You're never really able to retain people for as long as it makes sense for the benefit of our training. And it's this constant churning, and it really is a barrier to achieving efficiency. So what we are proposing is significantly reduce our part-time budget, our class 50 budget from FY21 to FY22, we utilize to fund class 10. We will see that there were a slight increase, approximately 2% increase, and we do that. So a lot of that depends on the budget side, exact size, so we also have increases in salaries and some increases. So in our efficiency budget, we're really looking to utilize our prior class 50. Fund for class 10 positions, 5 class 10 positions, an admin for you. We presently have a part-time person overseeing an entire bureau. That's really my position. And we need more as a person. Hearing aid examiner is just able to hire somebody for time for that. We previously didn't have anybody drafting legal positions and orders other than myself. And people who don't have the requisite things backwards to do that. And so we were going to be bringing that, but we need a full-time position for that. And then finally, we're really looking to achieve efficiency by leveraging technology. I've previously talked about EITM manager, and we're just looking at the EIT and business systems analyst. He actually starts tomorrow. We're very excited he's going to really lead the way and getting all our licenses in line. That's actually projected in our class 27 budget and our efficiency budget. Then we have some additional prioritized needs, mainly in our class 27. We need to keep going deeper for that, but we are improving investigation software and discussion software. Right now, when we first came in, we were not in a position to have any attorney prosecutor. We have one prosecutor for technical, the primary prosecution and investigation program right now. And there's a resource issue, so many of our cases were getting rejected, not being prosecuted, not being investigated, that has created the protect the public. And so rather than investing in additional people and an inefficient process, we think that making an initial short-term investment in technology that can really track these investigations can create a timeline and automate the process in terms of next steps, I think it's really going to miss that. And so that's what we're proposing for investigations. The same is true for inspections. We conduct inspections for pharmacies, cosmetology and barbershop, and then electricians. We may be getting into licensing and others that we need to conduct inspections. And all of this is done by hand, which I think is a barrier for allowing the staff to go out and do the inspections. They spend a lot of the time doing their paperwork, so that's on. So finally, on slide 8, how are we going to pay for this? I don't know if you can hear me. Can you hear me? It's on. Can you hear me now?
I
think
what happens is when you breathe, you put your head down, you're not talking anymore.
Can you hear me now?
I think it might be the battery might be dying.
Oh, okay.
I know, but like you look at it on the computer again.
Can you hear me now? No difference? No? Okay.
Huh.
So, can you hear me now? Not really hearing it. Excuse me, can I take yours?
Hi.
Woo, okay. All right, thank you. Thank you for bearing with me. Can you hear me now? Is that better? Okay. So then, lastly, we have to talk about how OPLC proposes to pay for its proposed budget. And OPLC is really unique in that we are a self-funded agency, and I think by virtue of the fact that the Supreme Court president has said that our fees have to bear a rational relationship to our proposed expenses. Based on our projected revenue, I think we can certainly afford this. This is a very conservative estimate. And I want to walk you through, we have, when taking into consideration double accounting for fiscal year 20, we were able to bring in $12 million, approximately. That is, we did experience a shortfall with pharmacies, which gave us back $700,000 due to a change in legislation. We also, that contemplates that the agency is going to be funding the PHP program. We're making some changes regarding service fees because as we've increased our use of online payments, we are eating the cost of the service fees. And then also, PDP has had, and I haven't talked specifically about PDP, but PDP has had some changes in terms of grant funding. So we've seen an increase in grant funding. That's not actually reflected. So I think based on all of that, a very conservative, estimate for revenue is in the $14.1 million range. And that's not factoring in the present increase, 29% increase in rate fees. And I wanted to keep that conservative because I don't know what COVID's going to do when it reforms, and I'm a very frugal person, and I think we need to keep it conservative. So that being said, you know, if you take that into consideration, our efficiency, we're at about 84%. Again, I think that's very conservative. And then, of course, with our additional prioritized needs, more than enough to cover our costs, and certainly bears a rational relationship to our fees. So, I'm happy to take any questions if I have for the presentation.
Thank you, Director. And thank you for your work. It is one of our newest agencies, and OPLC is things get off the ground, it's always good to kind of look at what's working, what's not. And so I think members of the legislature should not be surprised if the accounting structure that's in the efficiency budget does not impact, is not reflective of the accounting structure that's included in the governor's budget. The governor has been very impressed with the proposals from the department to reorg for both administrative efficiencies and also cost efficiencies. So, I just want to talk about the differentials between the revenues collected and the estimated proposed appropriations. Largest being the agency is allowed to collect 120% of its estimated costs, which would come out to about 80% of the revenue collected funds the agency, and 20% flows as revenue to the state's general fund.
Correct.
And you believe, given these cost estimates and the requested levels of appropriation, the agency can live within those parameters?
Sure.
Any other questions for OPLC from members of the committee?
One thing that I would like to add, if given the opportunity, is numbers reflected in slide 8. I think we need to take it out at some point, the PAP. Fiscal year 22 and 23, we are anticipating significant increase, or I think it's 21 and 22, significant increase in our expenses, primarily the fact that we have a CDC grant for our estimated $63 million for 3 years. So I think that's in light of the numbers. When you take that out, I think we're certainly closer to the 80% mark.
Thank you. Representative Ober.
Thank you. I think the legislature would probably support changing the format as you talked about. But when you come to budget hearings in the legislature, be sure you bring a crosswalk between what you had and what's in the budget so people can track back and forth. It would just make things so easier and not stop and have you come back another day, because I can hear the questions now. Not everybody's heard this presentation. Nobody will have the budget until you get there.
Excellent. Will do. Thank you.
Thank you.
Do we have any questions from the folks on the phone?
Do you have a question? Please turn on the phone.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do you remember how mad Division was? One was during their presentation to their representative.
Yeah.
It's a market improvement.
Yeah, it's a market improvement. I mean, they had to see the team every year. They didn't budget any dollars, but they staff there.
There's always road bumps, but we're getting there.
Yeah.
Lindsay's excellent. I'd like to call up the police standards and training. Please state your names and begin your presentation.
Thank you, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for this opportunity. My name is John Skippa. I'm the director of New Hampshire Police Standards and Training. I have with me today Major David Parento and Ms. Laura Lee Ames. In full candor, this is the first time any of the three of us have had this opportunity, and so any direction or guidance that you can provide us as we go through this would be much appreciated. I'm a quick learner. The mission of New Hampshire Police Management Training is to shape, sustain, and strengthen the competency and professionalism of New Hampshire law enforcement for the good of our state. We set the hiring and educational standards for all police, state corrections, and probation parole officers in New Hampshire. We operate the New Hampshire Police Academy. Every single sworn police officer in the state of New Hampshire must attend and complete this academy to become certified. These officers include state troopers, conservation officers, liquor investigators, local, county, deputy sheriffs. Anyone who has law enforcement authority must complete this academy. We further operate the part-time police academy. Again, any officer that works in a part-time capacity must also pass through our doors in order to gain their certification. Further, we also conduct and oversee the New Hampshire Corrections Academy, where every state corrections officer must attend in order to become certified for their job. We also provide a catalog of specialized advanced and in-service refresher training at our facility here in Concord. And we also provide that training regionally throughout the state to assist officers in completing their annual requirements to maintain their certification. The council also is responsible for overseeing disciplinary hearings, and they have statutory authority to suspend or revoke certification of officers that violate our council rules or who commit crimes or acts of moral turpitude. We provide services to law enforcement agencies, including a monthly newsletter that informs the police community about new laws, new court decisions, and new court in police tactics. We offer assistance and advice in the areas of police administration and management. We are an independent executive branch agency, and we are governed by 14 members of the Police Standards and Training Council, who are appointed by our governor. We are not affiliated with any law enforcement or prosecutorial agency, thereby avoiding potential conflict of interest with our regulatory function and decertification duties. We provide these services with 20 full-time and 5 part-time positions, which include sworn staff, clerical staff, and building maintenance employees. Our staff is assisted by adjunct instructors, most of whom are unpaid volunteers, and a small number of contracted instructors. We oversee, operate, and maintain a 77,000 square foot training facility located on 20.87 acres of ground across from the New Hampshire Technical Institute. Before you today, ladies and gentlemen, is the budget request. And for your consideration, I have provided the following 3 documents as supplemental materials in support of this budget request. Specifically, I have provided copies of Governor Sununu's Executive Order 2020-19, the final report from the Governor's Commission on Law Enforcement Accountability and Transparency, and the New Hampshire Office of Legislative Budget Assistance 2019 audit of police standards and training. As a director of this organization, I see these documents as a very clear roadmap for our organization to follow. They clearly define important benchmarks that are vetted, identified, and agreed upon by a number of stakeholders who felt that these benchmarks were in the best interest of New Hampshire law enforcement and for the ultimate benefit of the people of our state. After review of the Commission's report, Governor Sununu agreed with their importance and issued his executive order in support of these recommendations. I have used these documents to prepare this budget in a way where police standards and training can accomplish these important mandates. I had the opportunity to consult with members of the governor's budget office as I put this budget together and in support of those mandates. I feel a little guilty, Director, in that we are going to go a little bit over the our FY22 request of $3,705,868 represents a $46,487 increase from the FY21 adjusted authorized budget and a $379,206 increase above the FY22 efficiency target. Our FY23 request, $3,871,347 represents an increase of $165,479 over the FY22 request and $494,786 above the FY23 efficiency target. We are requesting this budget so that we can increase the current level of services to the citizens and law enforcement agencies of the state by allowing us to meet our obligations as set forth in Governor Sununu's executive order. Those recommendations that are put forth in the final report of the Governor's LEAC Commission and the 2019 New Hampshire LDS audit that made a number of observations that we needed to correct. At the same time, this budget will also allow us to continue to provide our up-to-date basic training to the newly hired law enforcement officers, to continue to offer specialized and refresher training for in-service officers, and to make sure that those who are being hired, trained, and maintain certification in the state as law enforcement officers are in full compliance with our rules and laws. I appreciate your time, and I stand ready for any questions that any of you might have.
Thank you, Director, and thank you and your team for your work putting together this budget. Per the governor's instructions, you did make adjustments to your budget to include full funding for all of the recommendations of the LEAC Commission. And so, as with the Department of Justice members, we'll not see those items specifically called out as they were included in the efficiency budget, but any additional detail can be provided by the commission. Are there any additional questions? We'll please start the training.
Good afternoon. Thank you, and I appreciate the presentation. Is it true that New Hampshire is fairly unique in that we only have one academy statewide?
That is correct, sir. As a matter of fact, we are one of the few states left that have the privilege of only having one police academy.
And you would agree that that is a net benefit for the state, especially when it comes to implementing sweeping changes like those in the LEAC.
You are absolutely correct, and I can also speak to that answer from experience as the director of a police academy in Massachusetts for a period of time where there is no continuity at all. They have a vast number of police academies.
Representative Ogle.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. Thank you for your presentation. We have lots of pages of things here to be provided, but what I can't find is a copy of the document that you were reading to us from. Did we get copies of that? I just haven't found it in here.
I'm sorry, ma'am. The document you see?
You were reading from a document.
Oh.
Do we have copies of that tucked in here someplace that I just haven't found?
I apologize if you do not, but I can assure you that you get those documents.
Oh, that was great. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
I was beginning to think I just couldn't find anything here. Thank you.
Does anyone on the phone have any questions? Please star five.
Five star.
Five star. All right, thank you very much. Please transfer.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your consideration.
And with that,
And I will note right on time, I'd like to call the Department of Administrative Services.
Administrative Services, which you can tell because it says that right there. So I'm here, and I was going to say behind me, but not exactly behind me. One behind me and one to my left are Joe Bouchard is the Assistant Commissioner of Administrative Services, and then, literally right in my blind spot, Kathy Keene is the Deputy Commissioner of Administrative Services. And I think all of you know both of them. Probably as well as I do. So, and I know a lot of you were thinking, I know who the pinhead from DAS is going to be talking to us, but who's going to be with him and who's the brains of the operation? And the brains of the operation in the cat mask, oh, you took off your cat mask, is Sarah Trask. Sarah Trask is our Chief Financial Officer, and some of you will recall that she was also the Chief Financial Officer before. About a year ago, has it been a year?
Been a year.
Been a year. Of the health benefits. So, and we are lucky to have her in both capacities. I want to talk to you a little bit about what DAS is. I thought a lot about this presentation and what we were going to do, what we're going to talk about, and what we're here for. And I want to start by saying if you have the agency budget in front of you, and I think some of you probably have that, do me a favor and don't look at it and just throw it away. I'm going to summarize it, but I'm going to talk to you about why I think it's not a useful document for you to pay any attention to whatsoever. But before I do that, I'm going to talk to you about who we are. And I have for you two things. One is a giant spreadsheet on an 11 by 17 paper. We have so few opportunities to use that size paper that it's always useful to take them. This explains to you, to some extent, who we are in a fairly complicated way. And the spreadsheet is a fairly accurate depiction of who we are, except in the ways in which it's confusing and inaccurate. But the big picture is there are three of us in boxes, well, four of us if you count Dawn, in the boxes at the top of the sheet, and there's a whole lot of stuff that goes on underneath. And I'm going to talk to you about the whole lot of stuff that goes on underneath. Administrative services is, to my mind, one of the most important things of government, like a skeleton, like a blood system, there's a name for that. I don't know what it is, but one of those kind of things that people don't necessarily pay attention to. You know, if you're banking, I'm not picking on anybody here, but you're like, oh, I get what you do. You do banking. Well, what do you guys do? Well, the point is that we do everything. There are eight major pieces of administrative services, and I want to talk about what those are. I'm going to start with Public Works, if only because Public Works as a division is in this building. There, I think. There, in that corner. The Division of Public Works. We manage and design construction projects, about $160 million, give or take. That goes up and down a little bit. There are currently about 120 projects in some form of development, except, of course, that there's kind of a freeze on, so some of those stages of development are on hold halfway through that process, so as Mac well knows. But we're a design and engineering firm, but we're also a construction management firm. If you think about it, when you build stuff, you want to make sure it's built right, it's built to standards, and we inspect it to make sure that concrete has to be sure, and ask me about 7-day tests and 28-day tests and slump tests and all that kind of stuff, and I know way too much, more than I should. A big piece of what I do of what we do as a department, we build accounting services. A lot of people think of accounting as, and they get a sense of what that is. And you probably don't know. The of the four people I introduced, I'm including myself in that, one of the four of us, that one, is an accountant. The rest of us are not. Joe, for example, not an accountant, doesn't know anything about accounting, except about 20 pages worth. But there's, and I say this because I've told this story before, we're in accounting meetings, right? And so I'm in there with Joe, who is, Joe is Joe, right? He's, you know, everybody knows Joe, and the budget is Joe. Joe is the budget.
Charlie, for the folks on the phone, please describe who Joe is.
Joe Bouchard, the assistant commissioner and state budget officer. But everyone knows that Joe knows everything about the budget. And Dana Kohler is our comptroller. She's one, probably the best comptroller in recent memory that we've had. Just very well suited to the job, and she's awesome. Neither one of them could do the other's job, and it makes me really happy when halfway through the audit staff meeting, Joe looks as confused as I do. So accounting is very complicated. The most important thing we do is we pay more than 13,000 people every 2 weeks. That's a really big deal. And it's, if you're one of those 13,000 people, it's a really big deal. And it's something that I said to someone early in my tenure when we were having an issue. I said, are the checks going out? And he said, yes, but we have to do this, this, and this. And I said, if the checks are going out, you and I can come back to work next week. The checks don't go out, we can't come back to work next week. So that's the thing. We also process 192,000 audited payments each year. That number goes up and down a little bit. It's probably over 200,000 at this point. We check stuff. We make sure the things we're doing are being done correctly and in a transparent way so that people can look at the books and know they can have trust in them. Without the CAFR, for example, the audit, which I will note for some time, each of the last 4 years, which is a wonderful thing, which may be why Dana is the best comptroller ever. Without that, we have to cease operations as an entity, which would be a problematic for the state of New Hampshire. FDM, Financial Data Management. Some of you who are more computery than the rest of us know exactly what this is, but for most of us, suffice it to say that everybody's got a computer on their desk, and this is that. Everything the state does goes through the state's computer system, the enterprise system. It's a really big deal, and no agency gets anything done if they don't get their job done. We manage 4 million square feet of office space, including this building and the grounds that are drawn. Most of these in private, actually, which is a big deal, and expensive and complicated. More than 90 buildings, and we help with 30 leased buildings as well. Procurement, we buy stuff as a state. The only one of my predecessors who went to jail over procurement, the Stephen Story affair in the late 40s. And it's why? Because you have to buy stuff. You have to bid stuff to get a good price, and so everybody has access to it. You have to bid stuff so there's no corruption in the state system. This is important. It's a big part of our thing. The state purchasing agent dates back to 1907, I think, maybe 1909. And it's the oldest piece of our department because it's critical to the state operation and the integrity of the state operation. We have a personnel office. The state is people. We support recruitment, hiring, training for every agency. We run a training group, the Bureau of Education and Training, which some of you know. You can't have an office without HR. I think people know that. The state budget office, and I'm looking at Joe here, they build the budget, they manage the system. The greatest joy of being budget director, and I'm looking at the two of you, in my tenure, there were a lot of wonderful things about being budget director. A couple of lousy things about being budget director too, but I won't talk about those. But the best part was meeting Joe and the budget team, which is an incredible team that does lots of stuff. And the state system does not work without it in ways that nobody knows or even understands. But transfers between state agencies, working with them, they review all fiscal committee items and manage the entire governor and council process. And if you are an agency that has to go through the governor and council process, you know that that's kind of a thing, and that's kind of a big deal. And we run, did I mention this before, a $500 million health plan, and as Kathy can tell you, that's a relatively simplistic process that has no complications in it, right? Piece of cake, easy to do. What I didn't mention is all the other stuff we do. I'm not going to talk to you about surplus property. I'm not going to talk to you about food distribution, which is the only major distributing agency. We're not going to talk about P cards. We're not going to talk about fleet management, the merchant card system we manage, the statewide mailing service operation that we manage. I'm not going to talk to you about any of that. We're not going to talk about the workers' comp program, the boat insurance, the car insurance, the other kinds of insurance that I can't even think of, including helicopter insurance. That's not going to come up, because that's just all the other stuff that we do. I didn't mention the FERC compensation, which is something that we do. I'm not going to talk to you about the Office of Cost Containment, because those are just some of the things we do, and it's why this sheet of paper is so large. But I say that to say that we are a central service agency. And the reason I was even interested in doing this, aside from the wonderful people I get to work with, and that has to be underscored, any job's great if you work with great people. Any job stinks if you work with lousy people. But it's because we touch every single piece of state government. And every single piece of state government needs us, wants us, needs us to help them. They can't do their job without us, which is an enormous amount of pressure, but it's also a wonderfully enriching thing to do. I want to talk to you a little bit about how our department should be thought of. We have two departments, not one. You should never think of our budget as the Department of Administrative Services. You should think of it as retiree health and the department, because they're two different things. And retiree health, Representative Ober knows better than anyone in this room, well, except Cassie and Sarah, exactly what can go wrong when there are problems with that. We had enormous issues in 15 and 16 with health and the budget process, and we would not have gotten to a place where retirees got their health if it had not been through a lot of hard work from a lot of people, including, quite notably, Representative Ober, who understands that it's a different thing. You can't look at our budget and go, yeah, how much did you guys go up? How much did you guys go down? And just find that somewhere else, because, you know, prescription drug costs went through the roof. It's just, so you really need to think of it as two different things. I've done that here and shown you the difference. Retiree health happens to be in a really, really remarkably, stunningly, never-to-be-seen-again good place through wonderful things that have happened. Joyce Pippin is the director of risk, and they've been doing great things. The Medicare Advantage changes have done wonderful things to state costs and allowed us to preserve benefits at, frankly, reduced costs and save the state tens of millions of dollars over the last 3.5 years. Which is a big deal. I want to turn to the third slide in front of you and say, why should you care? And it's because every agency relies on us. Every agency needs us. The processes and approvals of administrative services support their mission. If we do a lousy job, it is a frustrating, annoying thing for all of them, and it makes an enormous difference for them whether we do a good job or a bad job, whether we're able to process payments, process hiring, process benefits, process everything, support, audit, et cetera. They need us. The state and the taxpayers rely on us as the chief fiscal and policy control agency of state government. We are watchdogs, we are managers to make sure things are done legally and correctly across state government. I mentioned procurement, which saves hundreds of millions of dollars, probably. This year it'll turn out to be $550 to $600 million through procurement processes instead of just going, well, I know a guy who does fences, we bid fences, et cetera. All of that is critically important. What's happened in the past, between 2010 and 2017, we lost 41 full-time positions and more than a dozen part-time workers. Representative Ober talked to me about this my first week on the job. And told me not to ever let that happen again. In a couple of budgets since then, some of that has come back. I would like to say some of it was my foresight as budget director. I literally had nothing to do with it. We added a couple of positions here and a couple of positions there to improve some things. One of the reasons that CAPR is getting done on time is because we have a better staff. And I think that was Gerard and Representative Ober actually working together to make sure that happened. Which was a good thing. The message every commissioner gives to the governor is they need more speed and they need more flexibility. And that's us. They want us to provide them more speed and more flexibility. So why should you care about us? Because you care about the whole operation of state government. And I think that's critical. There are numbers at the back of this presentation which we can go through.
and I'll mention with you, but before we talk about what isn't happening and what got cut, and 70 or 80 vacant positions in our operations, I want to talk to you about two initiatives that should be on your radar screen. One is human resources. Human resources is the biggest operational frustration for people in the state. Hiring, the process. The process is cumbersome by design, and I think we all know that. We looked at what to do, and there's an age-old debate that dates back to the 80s and 90s, but it probably dates back to the 20s, about decentralization or centralization. And a lot of work, Al Gore's reinventing government report, whatever it's called, which I read, which suggests something that my commitment to looking into this stuff, I would actually read that. But they talk about that, decentralization, centralization. That's the wrong choice. The wrong choice is some things should be decentralized, some things should be centralized, some things should be both. In human resources, there are agencies. Transportation probably is one of them, but safety is definitely one. HHS, they have thousands of employees. They have a robust HR staff that can have specialization in payroll, specialization in FMLA, in benefits, in every little piece of it. And they have a robust operation. They should be given more authority to do reclasses by themselves. We're doing that to make decisions about which step to hire at, to run their own operation and not have to send everything, quote unquote, downtown to DOT. But there are a bunch of smaller agencies. You will hear and have been hearing from agencies with hundreds or thousands of employees and agencies with agriculture, 40 people. Labor, 60, 70 people. So we piloted a program, for example, with labor, where we're going to take resources. The Department of Labor has one person that does HR. Well, they're not an expert in everything, and they can't be. And because of the nature of the agency, it's going to be a person who can't do training at the same time that they're doing their job, because they can't do their job because there are too many pieces of their job. Well, what if we take all those little bits and pieces, six, seven here, and amalgamate them into a human resources support team, and combine those resources and provide better service. Mac is aware of this. We just hired housing, what's it called? Why am I losing it? Housing Appeals Board, the Board of Housing Appeals. Housing Appeals Board members, and we had this discussion where they're like, okay, somebody said to me, are you okay if they start on October 23rd? And I'm like, I don't care, what's it to me? And they're like, well, how are they going to get their check? And I said, well, their HR person would do that. Well, they don't have one because they're a new agency that doesn't exist yet. And so we talk about it. It's another part of the pilot program. So we have this central unit. In this case, it's COP because it hasn't fully formed yet, does it for them. That has to happen. This is a way of taking resources. It will be budget neutral, doing a better job with fewer resources. This is the kind of thing we should do. The Shared Services Center, raise your hand if you remember the Shared Services Center, a mistake which we got rid of because it was the wrong approach. We took the wrong thing to centralize, and we centralized it the wrong way. Instead, we're going to centralize what can be centralized and not centralize what doesn't need to be centralized. That's one. Two, I want to talk to you about the cloud. People know the cloud. Computer services are going to the cloud instead of on-site and on your computer. Do you need WordPerfect on your computer? You remember what WordPerfect is. Or Word, I should say. Thank you. things should be in the cloud. Our state ERP got into trouble 20 years ago because we bought a system. I want to say Governor Sununu the Elder bought a system. And they never updated it. They didn't do the updates. It became homegrown. People put in paper clips and coat hangers, and somebody's like, oh, I can do an add-on, and I know a guy who knows some old code from Lotus. Let's throw that in there. And by the end of its duration, nobody knew how it works. But two or three systems left in the state like this where they say, there's one 82-year-old guy that we've got working part-time, but sooner or later he's moving to Florida. And then we won't know how to do anything at
For the folks on the phone, the last legacy system is currently being retired.
Yes, except for a couple little ones. But the big ones are being retired. But we need to move things to the cloud. We're going to talk to you about, and as part of the budget process, it's
moving financial resources, moving the state's enterprise system to a cloud environment so that the updates are automatic and that every time we move from 9 to 10 or 10 to 11 or 11.1 to 11.2, there's not a giant cultural shift that destroys everybody. And it's the moral equivalent of doing a new ERP, which almost killed Joe, so we don't want to go through that again. Maybe it didn't almost kill Joe. He's much stronger than he was. These are the kind of things we want to do on a regular basis. Who in their right mind is thinking about these things on their average everyday basis? Most people are thinking about how do we get a water cleaner? How do we build more roads? But we're thinking about how do we build more buildings or how do we improve their energy efficiency? I didn't mention the state energy office that we also manage. But this is our job. This is our job is to look at all the little boring bits of state government. I have the smartest people in state government working for me, almost without exception. And certainly, you know, you can look around me in the room and you know that's largely true. That, you know, these are three of the smartest people in state government. We also deal with all the boring stuff in state government. And it's wonderfully boring and it's necessary. And that's what you need us for. Now, if you look at the spreadsheet in front of you, I'm sorry I'm talking too fast, but I can't help it. I'm excited today. Our agency budget, there's an expression, I think this comes from Maine, doesn't it? You can't get there from here. You know, the guy stops at the farm and says, I'm trying to go down the road, I want to get to this place. And how do I get there? He said, if I was you, I wouldn't start here. And that's where we are. I can produce for you a 95% budget, a 98% budget, a 102% budget, a 91% budget. And we can and will do our part, and we did do our part. If the state economy collapses again, if the V-shaped recovery-ish that we're having turns into what's an upside-down V? An upside-down V, then and you need us to cut 18.5%, this is the way to go. But if you say to me, based on where we are in revenues, et cetera, I need a 96% budget. I don't want to start here. I don't want to tweak this. I don't want to tell you that these are the four positions and these are the two positions. I want to say, what's the number, and then present you a plan to hit. And I say that because if you look at this, Sarah did this wonderful, and it's got the number six on it. Number six in a circle. I think it's Neil Kirk who always wanted those, right? Is it Neil? Somebody likes it, but... So I can just point at the big number in the circle. If you look at the additional needs, I appended to the positions. And there's position after position after position after position. How do we get to our cuts? Well, we're mostly people. People in retiree health. And so what did we do? I have 80, depending on how you count, 84 vacancies right now. We've been under a functional hiring freeze since July 1st of... Not this past one, but the one before that, because there's the CR, and then, you know, I said that, I remember I had this meeting with Jane, and I said, I can't hit my last target if I don't, without layoffs. And she said, let's look at that later, and then, like, that's 3 days before the state of emergency, so we didn't look at it. So what do? We have lots of positions. We can't function as an agency at the level of service anybody wants with 90 vacancies. We just can't. We were able to achieve good things by some of the positions coming back. Representative Ogre knows very well what happened in accounting services. In the last budget, we had a look at FDM, and we were never able to fill those because of the virus hits. We would need to look at that and say, what can we do, what can't we do? But at this staffing level, we can't do what we do today. We can't. And we're struggling with that now. Buildings are a little bit easier to clean when nobody's in them. But when they're actually not as much easier to clean as you would hope, right, when nobody's in them. But you still got to clean those bathrooms. You still got to mop the floors and wipe off all the door handles, and particularly in a virus situation. But I would want the ability to prioritize. And, you know, I don't have the positions open that you would want me to have open. I think if I said to any director, I need you to go down to three people, they'd say, can I pick the positions where it's going to cause me the least vulnerability? and I'm going to say, no, I need you to pick the person who happened to have a stroke or the person who happened to turn 65 and retire. And we, I'm going to use one example. We had a guy retire in accounting services, Tim Hartshorn, who some people know. Tim is sort of legendary in state government, and you can't do year-end close without Tim, but we did. And we can't hire a new Tim because what are we doing right now? We have the openings that happened to happen. And the openings that happened to happen is not strategic. It's not a strategy. It's not a plan. It's an accident. So why are these positions in the efficiency budget? Because if you've got to cut your budget by 18.5%, where do you start? We made an actual conscious decision to say, is this the appropriate method? I don't know, but it's the one we're going to take. We're going to start by eliminating the positions that are open. Because on the human level, that's where we started. And then we're going to figure that out from there. If it's permanent, if we're going to be permanently go down from 400 and 470, we go down from 470 to 370, we're going to have to take a real, real serious look at a lot of things that we do. If it's a thing we're going to live with for a year and a half, then I'm going to try to, as a starting point, I'm going to try not to lay people off. And I think that's the decision a lot of people would make. But that's my way of saying three things. If we figure out where we want to be, let's not start from here to get there. And let's take a fresh look at it. Please think of our budget as retiree health and everything else. This year it's a bonus for us that it's retiree health is going down. Next year it's not going to be, but the needs of running an efficient accounting operation or running an efficient design and construction department don't change because retiree health goes up and down. And then there's the kind of things we have to look at. In terms of what else we did, this is the global view. And I'm happy to answer any questions about any of that. A little disjointed, but you know where I'm coming from.
Thank you, Commissioner Arlingas. As always, a highly entertaining presentation. I'm going to request that when you get back to your office, you send me a copy of the state bumper sheet policy.
Okay.
You mentioned it, so.
All right.
At a high level, I think that we all the members of the committee, understand that it is retiree health and everything else, and we should have we should segregate those conversations and give them wherever time. I'm speaking for myself, and I imagine Representative Ober is also interested in retiree health. But on the actual operations of the department, since you are a shared services agency, your department's budget impacts every other agency within state government. And as we do talk about the Department of Administrative Services and the important functions you provide, it's, I think, important to talk about what the fund mix of your shared services actually are. It's not other funds. It's lottery funds, general funds, it's
sure.
Federal funds. So as we move forward with the conversations in the governor's phase and the legislative phase, always keep that context in mind of what the fund sources are.
One of the things we did, if you look at the plan property budget, which is where the lion's share of the double counted, for lack of a better word, stuff is. Based on our directions, we reduced our spending for total funds. We didn't say, oh, well, general funds and all that, because I'm going to use an example. Bureau of Court Facilities is a third of our property bureau, our plant property bureau, right? We manage the court buildings. It's paid 100% with, quote unquote, other funds, a transfer from the judicial branch. All of the judicial branch's funds our general funds. So, you know, they got to hit a number, we got to hit a number. And we tried to have conversations with every agency as we did that about, look, this is what we're doing. You've seen already some people say, you know, our prioritized need includes DAS's prioritized need. And you know, they get that. They would like their elevator service. They would like their floors cleaned. And we didn't eliminate that. But, you know, a big part of how you get on property. And if you look at our budget, a big chunk of it is property, right? Half of our staff is planning property, probably slightly more than that. You know, you get there by stopping doing maintenance. The state's been doing that for 20 years. We've done less maintenance and less maintenance and less maintenance. Some buildings, that's okay-ish, kind of. And some buildings are just falling apart. And a lot of work last year, with your support and the legislature's support, we created a maintenance fund. But frankly, because of COVID, it's not being spent because, you know, I don't mean just being COVID. I mean the economic distress that comes as a result of that, too. It's a future plan that's going to be helpful, but it's something we rely on. There are a lot of things we can do to make stuff better for people, but we rely on your help. You know, things get better when the governor's office acts and the legislature acts, and we're functionally your servants.
Representative Hogan.
Thank you. Charlie, thank you. I know you will have
well,
I know you've heard me say this, in fact, I've been saying this to Commissioner since Linda Hodgkin was the DA.
Thank you.
But can you, when you start with the governor this time, because I'm not sure this is something that done at the governor level, or you wait till you get to finance, and I ask you, I hear what you say about these 84 people, and I understand not laying off people, so you take the empty position. But the corollary of that, and I think the side that everybody needs to think about, is what section needs to be put into HB2 to suspend services to financing because we can't afford to fund the services. And this certainly impacts your agency to a great deal. So I ask you to start that with the governor when you get to House Finance. I know you will be asked to do that.
So there's been, and you know this, there's been a section because you asked this question, depends on the option, I gather. But in 17 and in 19, there were some sections. And so there are some things we absolutely can look at spending. We want to have a conversation about it as opposed to tell you what we think. You know, managers, there's always something that annoys a manager. That's the wrong expression. There's, you know, when you're running a unit, let's say, there's some things that really interest you. And there are other things that really interest somebody else. And we need to do make sure we do a good job of balancing the things that really interest somebody else and may not interest Sarah, although Sarah is very agreeable. And so we want to have that balance and we want that to be a conversation.
I agree about the conversation. I just think you need to also start that at the government as well. Because clearly, with COVID, with the growing situation, and even in a good year, we don't fund everything. No matter how much we love every agency, there's always things we don't get funded. But we need to understand, if we don't fund, what are we spending? And we need to suspend, because if you get a performance audit, you get a nasty hit because the legislature and the governor didn't have enough money to fund that, which isn't fair to them.
It's a really good point. We're going to start that now. I think that's happening. I think Mac will back me up on this. Probably at every agency where you're saying, I feel like the governor said on a conference call once, think about core functions and think about prioritizing what you do. Because, you know, particularly when we talk about hiring freezes and you know, if you can't bring people back, what do you need to spend? So it's something we're definitely, we have conversations all the time. I don't know why I'm pointing at you, but you're completely in my blind spot. But we're all the time about, you know, what are the core things? What are the three priorities? If we only get three things done over the next 3 months, what are they? And how critical is it? And sometimes it's the thing that we think is most critical. And sometimes it's based on a bill, it's the thing that we got a clear message from a legislator or from the legislature acting in its bill capacity. then it's what they think is the most critical. And that's something that we have to look at every day.
Representative Walker.
One thing I've heard through the years is the Yellow Pages test. We're doing something that we can look up in the Yellow Pages. If someone does it, we go up and contract with them. And you know, sometimes it's a big savings, especially when you have all these expenses for a state employee that helps out. Some of those things we can look at, especially if it's just something that's all seasonal or not full time. That's a big savings for us. Some heard some mayors and governors talk about all the money they save because of the Yellow Pages. Just a thought.
I think it's a good thought, and I want you to know it's something that we actually do a lot of. I'm going to use property as an example of it. We had a conversation the other day. Cleaning is a big struggle. One of the things we have are BSW-2s and BSW-3s, building service workers, who are cleaning staff and we're great and do a lot of great work. There's a question about how much added value full-time versus part-time gets. We have a ton of part-time people. And we're in a situation right now where our vacancy rate in that class of position is, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but something like we have 114 positions and we have 25 or 6 vacancies right now. And so you look at it and you say, and you know, the managers say, I can't keep the building clean. And if this agency brings the staff back, as every agency is starting to do, we can't keep this building clean. And so what do we look at? And the question is, one, can you find people? Even if there weren't a hiring freeze, could you find anybody? And then two, could we contract with a company? Courts has done a lot of work on that in the past because, you know, when you're centralized, somebody cleaning on Hazen Drive, for example, well, I'm cleaning DOT today and there's no reason I can't go down to the Hayes building in 2 days or to DMV or whatever. That it's not six of one half dozen of another. The state hospital campus. There's 16 buildings and the job is very similar in each of them, some exceptions. But if you're a court in Conway, you can't do Conway and Plastow at the same time. And so we looked at contracting. Easier with cleaning, harder with things like snow removal because of the nature of those tasks. So, but it is something you're right. If you can contract cheaper, we should. And if we can't, we shouldn't. So since Mike Connor, we've been looking at that, I think.
Any questions from other members of the committee or the folks on the phone?
Do you have a question on the phone? I'm
hoping for a phone question.
She said that there was a good question.
DRA is the only no phone question. Thank you, Commissioner Arlinghouse.
Thank you, and hello to everybody on the telephone.
Thank you, Commissioner. Next, we have the Office of the Child Advocate, attached to the Department of Administrative Services. Do we have the director on the phone?
Good afternoon. This is Moira O'Neill. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you. Thank you, Director. Please introduce yourself and any of your members of your staff, jump into your presentation.
Thank you. It's Moira O'Neill. I'm the child advocate, and I'm accompanied today by Karen Kimmel, who's our program specialist and our person most responsible for keeping all the numbers correctly. It's great to be before you folks on the budget advisory panel. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you about the Office of the Child Advocate. I'll give you a brief background of the office, which will give context to our workload and therefore our resource needs. The office is in its third year of existence. It was established in response to multiple gaps in functioning of the child welfare system, which culminated in tragedy that prompted system reform, including this office as a mechanism of oversight. It's our job to make sure that when the state inserts itself in a family's world, when it endeavors to help a family stay strong and together, or in the worst case scenario, has to take a child away from his or her family, that it's done carefully and that it's sensitive, it's within the law, and with the best interest of the child in mind. So we also serve somewhat as a buffer between the state and the community, working with the Division for Children, Youth, and Families, which is possibly the most untrusted state agency. We're working to build a better relationship between them and helping them to overcome their negative reputation. So we provide oversight and promote children's best interests as a mandate in four main roles. So first of all, we receive complaints or concerns. Many of those calls warrant information and referrals or coaching to navigate the system. The rest we investigate and advocate on behalf of the children's interests. When complaints are unresolved or reflect a wider system problem, we work with the agency to resolve them. So each complaint is captured and monitored for trends and system gaps. Second, we receive reports of incidents involving children in the custody or supervision of the state. And these may include child death, injuries, restraints, seclusion, abuse, or when children are missing. Each incident is reviewed, entered into a database, and monitored for trends in practices or in system gaps. And then third, we are mandated to regularly consult with and provide advice to executive agencies, the Oversight Commission on Children's Services, legislators, the governor, and the public. So we're also required to provide outreach and education about the office, and more importantly, about how state services operate for certain and when helping children. We also provide education about children in general with an emphasis on child development. We conduct research and provide information on best practices, scientific developments, and opportunities to develop responsive, efficient state services. So in 2020, after less than 3 years of operations, the legislature and the governor demonstrated a powerful vote of confidence in this office by expanding the mandate and jurisdiction. So Chapter RSA 21V went into effect on September 18th, just less than a couple months ago. The new mandate includes oversight of all state-provided, funded, or agreed-upon services for children. We're also now required to periodically visit children who are placed out of their homes and assist them as needed. So our annual report was just released a little over a week ago, and that provides a good summary of our current workload. And I'll give you a quick review of all of that for our reporting year that went from October 1st, 2019 to September 30th, 2020. In that time, we received, reviewed, responded to, and monitored 2,182 incident reports and 312 citizen complaints. We conducted and reported 14 comprehensive individual child case reviews. We conducted brief reviews and analyses of 18 child deaths, identifying relevant public health needs. We facilitated 3 system learning reviews of critical incidents with teams of DCYF personnel. We conducted 10 critical incident reviews with summaries of child and parent deaths, missing children, near-death incidents, and domestic violence. We embarked on 3 facility reviews and monitored DCYF special investigation of facilities. We led the working group on juvenile justice in a review of the system with an aim to reform. We published 1 issue briefing regarding COVID-19 quarantine needs. We provided legislative advocacy and testimony and consultation. We participated in over 30 events of outreach, education, and information, and we participated as active members on 14 committees or advisory groups. So in terms of the state budget, the Office of the Child Advocate is almost incidental. Nearly all of our resources are invested in personnel, and despite the amount of work we're able to do, we're actually just a few. Currently, our operations include 5 full-time equivalent positions, with 1 of them unfilled and frozen and pending an appeal. We have 1 temporary part-time position, and we have an operating budget right now of $551,375. That includes funding for that unfilled full-time equivalent. We are an independent agency attached to the Department of Administrative Services for administrative purposes, but apart from personnel matters, we still conduct the majority of our administrative responsibilities, requiring a significant amount of staff time. So we estimate that subtracting administrative duties, we currently have about 3.5 full-time equivalents dedicated to the mission and the mandate of the office. While we have been remarkably productive, we need that 1.5 FTE to meet all mandated obligations, such as meeting with children, reviewing a greater sample of critical incidents, and conducting deeper analyses of performance outcomes on the agencies we oversee. So the office is striving to achieve the austerity the governor is seeking from executive agencies. But because of change in the statutory mandate, we are in some ways a new agency with new budget needs. At a bare minimum, in fiscal year 21, we need to fill out the frozen planning analyst program coordinator position. This will give the office the ability to produce meaningful analysis to meet the mandate of consulting with and effectively advising decision makers in the state government. In fiscal year 22, we really need to add a full-time assistant child advocate to accommodate increasing oversight activities imposed by the expanded jurisdiction. The numbers of complaints and incidents I just shared with you are associated with DCYF alone. With the expansion of the jurisdiction, we expect to get more from about other agencies. This position would share responsibilities for receiving and processing increased complaints, conducting investigations, and assisting with expanded outreach and education. Additionally, the office requires a full-time legal aid. Currently, the part-time temporary position has primary responsibility for managing data collection and entry of the incident reports. DCYF compliance with that reporting only commenced in December of 2019, and since then we've received, as I said, over 2,000 incident reports. That doesn't yet reflect full reporting compliance. For example, we are not receiving reports of incidents involving children who are placed out of state or incidents involving children who are placed by their schools. So the volume is beyond capacity for any other positions in the office, and the mandate to surveil incidents would be unmet if we didn't get this position filled. With the additional personnel, there'll be associated costs such as computer equipment, phones, and training. And I will say, Commissioner Arlinghouse has been generous. We actually use several used computers and laptops to save money. We've been very resourceful in that way. But we still will need more equipment for the two new positions. And once the pandemic restrictions are lifted, we'll have a great deal of catching up to do with visiting children to observe their circumstances in and out of state facilities. In fiscal year 23, we may need a vehicle to reduce travel expenses. We expect that the data from fiscal year 22 travel expenses will inform whether or not we need that, but we believe we probably will. And then the Departments of Information Technology and Administrative Services imposed unanticipated increased expenses on the office not incurred in previous budgets. We believe those are budget neutral moves from their budgets to ours. But the costs are associated with a change of status to an independent agency with a unique agency number, despite our being attached to the Department of Administrative Services. So we've sought to identify potential revenue streams or grant opportunities to reduce these general fund burdens. But even that kind of effort increases our workload, and we haven't been very successful to as yet. The office was created for oversight, the importance of which elevates in times of economic crises. There's an abundance of evidence demonstrating that family economic stress parallels stress in the state social services. So this is a point of highest risk and liability for state systems. So both the children and the state benefit from independent eyes on systems to ensure best outcomes. For all of these reasons, and to meet the mandate of Chapter RSA 21V equitably in a timely manner for all children and citizen complainants, the office is requesting a budget for fiscal year 22 at $816,794 and fiscal year 23, $862,134. Thank you for the opportunity to explain these circumstances. I welcome questions if you have any. I apologize for the delay getting copies of the statement to you, but I will send that over as soon as I can.
Thank you, Director O'Neill. I would just
like to add to that summary of the history of the office and where you see it going, that the governor and the legislature have made made child protection a focus over the last few years, where unfortunately the focus has not been there in the past, and significant investments have been made into DCYF. And while in the past maybe there has been a perception of it not being trusted, the state is doing everything we can to rebuild the trust with the public, and I think those efforts are starting to come to fruition. And the work of the Office of the Child Advocate is integral to that work to ensure that there's independent oversight. So thank you for you and your team and your work has been done. And just want to state that you know, we're making progress. I think that's a core thing to add here.
Yes, thank you. We agree 100%. It's been, even just in the past week, it's been almost breathtaking hearing about some of the things that are happening, new programs that are rolling out. It's really terrific to have this kind of commitment, and we feel very privileged to be a part of it.
Do members of the committee have any questions? Anyone from folks on the phone?
If you have a question.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think we got disconnected, but it's not as though you're finished with us.
Yes, thank you.
All right, great. Thank you so much. Thanks for all the work you guys are doing.
Thank you. So my name is Rebecca Skye, and I'm currently serving as the Executive Director for the New Hampshire State Commission on Aging. I hope to catch you up on some of your time today. I appreciate the opportunity to present on our budget. The Commission was created last legislative session via RSA Chapter 19T. Its charge is to advise the governor and the general court on policy and planning related to aging. It met for the first time just over a year ago, September 2019, and has met monthly since, only missing the March meeting that was scheduled the day after the stay-at-home order was issued. The commission first asked us to hire an executive director. I was hired as January 31st, 2020. Over the summer months, via remote means, we engaged in a strategic planning process, resulting in our strategic map that outlines our priorities for the next 3 years. This map is included on the backside of our executive summary of our first annual report. Joe Chard has a copy of our executive summary that we will distribute. It's also been submitted electronically. The full report was delivered November 1st to the governor's office with leadership within the leadership within the legislature, and is also available on our website. The reason why this commission is so important is taken in the opening lines of the executive summary. One out of every five of us in the Granite State is over the age of 60, and this number is set to grow over the next 20 years. Our state agencies and state policies need to be responsive to changing demographics. The role of the commission is to drive and support this responsiveness. There's no question COVID-19 disproportionately impacts older adults. Since the onset of its impacts, the commission has sought to address emerging issues. In an early letter to the governor's economic reopening task force, we sought to highlight, among other things, the outside size role older adults play in our state economy, and the need for them to feel safe in our community to continue to play that role. Older adults have more discretionary income than other age groups. We sought to bring forward social isolation issues experienced by older adults in long-term care facilities, encouraging DHHS to develop a more nuanced visitation policy that was realized September 28th. There are even more recommendations in our annual report in response to COVID-19. We now quickly shift to our discussing our budget. You'll notice the fiscal year 20 budget was rather small. Fiscal year 20 was a partial year and expenses like that. We are on target for fiscal year 21. This budget and the fiscal year 22-23 budgets provide for my salary and very, very basic office operations. The fiscal year 22-23 budgets are consistent with the targets that were provided. Speaking to the prioritized needs, budget. Currently, the 26-member commission has an active one. The largest ask in the prioritized need budget is for part-time administrative staff. This will allow me to fully focus on the role of the executive director, writing grant proposals to bring additional resources to the state, supporting the core task forces of this commission that were created as a result of the strategic planning process, and basically create the desired impact of the commission. We just heard of the amazing work of the Office of the Child Advocate, and they're able to do that because of having staff. Really, it's a difference between being mission-focused and myself splitting my time, reporting the number of the copies in the copier, the police agent, et cetera, making sure the cell phone bill is paid, instead of really paying attention to driving a policy in our future of our state. So thank you so much. Here to answer any questions.
Thank you, Director. I believe you are the newest agency that we've actually stood up for Standing Up Housing Now. So it's completely understandable that as this budget moves from the governor's phase and legislative phase, the incidental costs associated with Standing Up Agency will come better. So thank you for your work meeting the governor's targets. And as you learn more, I'm sure you'll know more now than when you submitted this number of months back. Please reach out to let us know. Copy or lease exchange. I mean, that's really the phase we were at the agency. So.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. And I just wanted to share my appreciation for Sarah Kraft, who's been immense with us.
Sarah, any questions from members of the
committee? You're also calling for questions. We have 5 minutes to start.
Thank you very much.
It's not about like getting off. I'm not even sure that works.
So next we'd like to call the New Hampshire State Lumber Commission.
Aggressively than we have previously, but aggressively. They represent a large revenue stream for charities, not so much for the state. This is the third year we've launched a new product line. We launched sports betting in FY20. I don't have to look at it because I know we shattered the record for e-commerce launch. We got GMT approval November 25th. We launched an e-commerce platform December 30th, which I, you know, I dare you to find the space if I did that. So that launched December 30th. COVID got in the way of that. We do old letter and food and fruit basket because he had Russian ping pong playing still in March, April, and May. We do be on edible arrangement because we're doing sports betting for Russian table tennis and Burundian soccer. And so when July, August, September, when sports came back, our revenues and sports betting came back roaring. Our best month was last month. DraftKings, which runs our retail as well as our mobile sites, their top facility in Seabrook and nationally. We are one of the top states in the U.S. for revenue per capita for a state entity for sports betting. And then we launched iLottery 2 years ago. That continues to grow at a rapid pace and represents a significant revenue stream. As you can imagine, we concern ourselves more with revenue than expenses. Our revenues are a factor of 10, I think, or pretty close to it, as versus our expenses. And I don't think, at least in my 10 years I've been here, we've never once come close to setting a budget. And when we did last year, we were expected this year. My colleague to my right is fanatical about, you know, keeping tabs on folks and spending, so it's pretty much his job to be the brakeman, but he does it well. So I think I'm behind, you're behind. Mr. Starling House. So obviously, I think you folks are familiar with what we do and how we do it. Happy to answer questions with the members of the community that have.
Thank you, Director. So I have two questions. One is about your product and one is about the actual budget. Can you give us kind of a breakdown on where you see the different growth potentials for your different products? I'm looking on the first slide and, you know, obviously a relatively new product, 7.4% overall, impressive. But looking at some of the other things, I mean, racing and charitable gaming, is there much growth potential there, or is the growth potential for lottery revenues really associated with some of our new products?
The short answer is sports betting will hit its apex pretty soon. Particularly in sports betting, the law of diminishing returns. We are probably at 65%, 30% capacity for sports betting revenue. In order to get that last 30%, we would have to overspend. We'd have to open up facilities and markets where it wouldn't be profitable. And it's, you know, 25% of our revenue on the mobile side, internet side, comes from out of state. Probably 75% of our revenue on the retail side comes from out of state. Seabrook does $1.4 million a week in sports betting. At least 3/4 of that is from Massachusetts. And I say that knowing it's probably going to end up in the bus tower tomorrow. But so expanding that, we're looking at a couple locations, similarly on the border. But other than that, that's probably going to be the apex of our revenue. The acquisition cost in sports betting really diminish over a certain number in terms of the value of the lot and the lifetime value of the player. And that, I think, we're not at the apex, but we're close, right? It's a new problem. It's not, you know, if you like sports betting, you found this pretty quick. Keno, for us, for example, when we did the revenue estimate for the legislature, we did it on 250 locations, $500 a day. We've never hit 250 locations. We're only about 200. And sometimes, you know, last week we hit $900 a day for those locations that were doing business. And so for us, if you were to say lottery, I'm not saying you are, but say the legislature and the governor would say the local option is removed, and we were to say open up it to all taverns that wanted it, we would probably triple Keno revenues in 6 months. And right now our current run rate is $802,000 a week Keno. I think we're number 3 per capita in the country for casino sales, and we're only in 200 locations statewide, and there are massive gaps on the map. sort of west and south of the state, there's virtually nobody that does TINA personally. It's very sporadic. You know, really the bulk of our sales are Manchester, Nashua, and points like that. So if you grow, right? Obviously, through the discussion in the legislature, there's a local option. It became politicized, like often things do. I sat in Dover. The same night, they had a school funding rally, which I felt like, you know, Mayor McCheese, the vegetarian convention. It was just very unpleasant. So, like, I'm education funding, but, you know, I just, you know, please, you know. That would be the sort of the easiest one. And also, for the purposes of business, so bars and taverns that run TINA currently, we polled them through UNH polling. 3/4 of the bars and taverns that responded that their other business had increased, and the majority was above 10%. And so that's real growth. On the other side of the equation, obviously, Meals and Rooms Tax doesn't capture it, but certainly, I mean, there are some places that have doubled their beer revenue and have, you know, there's locations on the border. I'm thinking of Summersworth, where one location, it's virtually a main bar. And so that adds to the overall revenue stream in the happy way, right? And so that would be the easy split for us. In terms of it being something we do, core function, able to scale quickly.
Thank you for that. And again, excellent work as part of the commission on rolling out that product and sports betting. The administratively attached agency, part of Lottery, the Council on Responsible Gambling, obviously, new agency was somewhat of its work was paused because of the pandemic. Fully expect them to be operational and up and running and beginning their work within the next biennium.
Yes. Okay. Absolutely. Yeah, and they're getting after it. Yes.
Any Representative Over.
Sorry, good to see you.
Thank you, Representative.
Your Form E has a number of legislative changes that you were recommending. Did you work with House member or senator to file those, or would you look at the governor put that as a sheet too?
It certainly was a holdover from a prior effort we made last time. We had written a sort of omnibus bill that had gotten stuff had gotten tacked onto and didn't go anywhere. So we had to work with any member of the legislature. There was a number of things we were looking to do at HB2. A lot of those in the there, yes.
Thank you.
Congratulations. Thank you. And also the good news is our revenue expectations continue to increase. The good news.
I look forward for an update, Charlie.
And this year, we're, you know, our expectations on our current run rate of the plan is conservative. So please don't close it. If you can avoid that, be great.
I have no control over that, but if I did. Any questions from the folks on the phone? Thank you very much to the State Department and now we'll call the Department of Transportation.
Can I just say, Charlie's a young
It's really the larger.
I'm only 31.
In my head, I feel like I'm like 25, you know?
Somebody told me the other day that I look pretty good for 72.
Well, I think it's good laugh. Folks edit the questions on the way in, basically saying gastro distress, more than normal.
So, I'm like, hey, you got to go with gastric distress and diarrhea, and I'm
like, oh, looks like you. Well, I was thinking, you know, this is the budget hearings at the legislature. It truly really will be gastric.
Gastric distress, a little bit.
Is there a better spot to look for it? Yeah. I'll move to you. Thank you for joining.
Snellis, the manager, jump in your presentation.
Good afternoon. My name is Troy Sheehan, for the record, Commissioner of Public Transportation. And with me today are Marie Mullen, our Director of Finance, Chris Wozchuk, our Deputy Commissioner, and Bill Cass, our Assistant Commissioner. I will start the presentation, and Marie is going to then talk about the numbers in our budget, and then I'm going to ask Deputy Commissioner Wozchuk to join me as we talk about some of our challenges and additional need requests. So first of all, welcome to DOT. I know it's late in the day to formally welcome you, but I'm glad we're able to accommodate you. And please let us know especially now we've changed to tomorrow or Monday. We've worked hard to try and make sure that we're keeping you all safe during your time here at the department. So it's my pleasure to present our agency phase request for the 22-23 budget. As we have traditionally done in the past, we have prepared budget books that were passed out. By statute, we're required to produce an annual report. This document is essentially our annual report with some additional budget information layered on top. And so it hopefully gives you a sense of what each of our different bureaus and work units accomplish each year. And then included, we have the number of positions as well as the relevant budget information. So as we go through the presentation today, we will reference this document periodically. And then in preparation for today, we do have a cover letter, which I'm not going to read verbatim. We'll just talk about it as we go through the presentation. So just a recap of who we are at DOT. Our mission here is to deliver transportation excellence and enhancing quality of life. We recognize that our work is extremely important. Every time somebody gets behind the wheel of their car, gets on a school bus or a public bus to get to work, they are relying on us to make sure that system is there for them to use. And we have a very dedicated and committed group of professionals here at DOT who put safety first and foremost in everything that we do. With COVID-19, there has been some revenue challenges, and this is a budget that truly reflects our highest priority. Safety is always our number one focus, and so you'll see that reflected in what we include in our agency space budget. I also want to spend some time today just reminding folks how the DOT budget is a little different from other agencies. We are very fortunate that we have a robust 10-year plan process, which is how we program the majority of the federal funds, as well as term type and betterment funds that flow into actual improvements to our assets. So all of our road and bridge work, as well as the programming of our federal funds that support the other modes of transportation, all of that is done through the 10-year plan. And so when we come before you to talk about our operating budget, we're really asking for support and concurrence with what we've identified as the needs on the true operating style expenses, even though all those federal funds and other sources of revenue are flowing through the budget. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Marie, who's going to talk about the numbers in a little bit more detail, and then I'll come back and discuss some of the decisions and choices we had to make for this particular agency budget.
Good afternoon. So just some general information about what the highway fund is and what the highway fund is not. So the highway fund is unrestricted revenue that's collected by the Department of Safety. Sometimes that's a misnomer. They think DOT, people think DOT collects it, but it is collected by the Department of Safety. And that's mainly road, toll, and motor vehicle fee registration. The highway fund also includes the DOT's federal apportionment from FHWA. So that is included as part of our budget. And as the commissioner said, that is identified in the 10-year plan and is put through our budget. And the highway fund also includes our Garvey bond, DAP, and TIFIA proceeds, which are federal loans that we have acquired that use federal funds to pay back the Garvey bonds. And the TIFIA is where the 4.2 cents road toll will be paid back that loan as well. What the highway fund is not The highway fund is not the Department of Transportation. The Department of Transportation is not the highway fund. The highway fund funds several agencies, primarily the Department of Transportation and the Department of Safety, but other agencies also get funds from the highway fund, including the Department of Justice and others as well. The highway fund is not through the turnpike fund. Department of Transportation oversees and manages the turnpike fund, but they are separate from and they cannot be used on each, for each other. The turnpike fund can only be used for the turnpike system and cannot be used on state roads that the highway fund supports. So the DOT budget includes multiple funds. We have general funds in our budget, highway funds, turnpike funds, and also capital funds. The capital fund is where primarily our buildings, facilities, software, and equipment gets funded through the capital fund. And as the commissioner said, the capital fund does not include our tender plan. That is part of our operating budget. Some of the major components of our budget this year, well, in the 22-23 budget, our total funds across the total budget across all funds is $668 million. $313 million of that, about 47%, is for our operating budget, and about 53%, or $354 million, goes towards municipal aid and construction. So we have, and about at least $65 million plus of the highway fund goes directly towards municipal aid and goes direct to the cities and towns. In our book here, they've included in the back a pullout, and that details out for our fiscal year 20 actuals all of the direct funds and also projects and anything in what town or city that they were in, and it shows the economic benefit that all of these cities and towns have received from the DOT through the year, whether it's through projects or through direct funding like the block grant. For FY23, our budget was approximately $673 million. Overall, this is a 3.5% decrease from our just authorized FY2021, and only a slight increase of 0.8% of our FY22 budget. Our federal funds within this budget have remained flat. Currently, the FAST Act, which is the federal authorization for our federal funds, is in a continuing resolution and has been remained flat for FY21. Congress has funded it flat to FY20. So we are assuming that without knowing what a new authorization bill will look like, we have assumed the flat budget to the FY20 task act authorization for our 22 and 23 budget as well. So the current draw on the highway fund is about $215 million in FY22, which was a reduction of 6.1% compared to FY21. And in FY22, it's $223 million, a decrease of 2.9% over fiscal year 2021 adjusted authorized. And the turnpike funds were reduced by 7.5% in FY22. And in FY23 remain well funded. So based on the target that was provided, the department views the lower areas where we had identified reductions to be able to meet the target. First, in the general fund, we have aeronautics, UAS drone planner position that was funded in the last budget. And due to the constraints aside from the general fund, we have that as an additional meeting that we'll discuss later, but we're hoping to get that funded. That is an important area for us with the increase in drones and the compliance we have related to that program. In the highway fund, we significantly reduced our fleet equipment, some preventative maintenance programs that were put in the last budget. We reduced this time to maintain the target. So one of these is guardrail replacement contracts. We have bridge washing contracts, tree trimming, refuse removal, and some environmental on the tour that will reduce cuts in our budget. And in the turnpike fund, we had a reduction in debt service. We had some personnel reductions related to the conversion to all electronic tolling in Dover and Rochester in fiscal year 23. And we also are projecting some delays in the start of certain projects in our capital program on the turnpike side to be able to meet the budget targets. At this point, I'll turn it over to Commissioner Sheen and Deputy Commissioner Washington to discuss the challenges we need to pass going forward. So for anyone who travels on our roadway network, I think it's been pretty obvious how COVID-19 has impacted transportation. We really were pleased to see the reduction in traffic initially. We saw folks still moving around, and then they were taking the governor's executive order seriously and doing their part to slow the spread of COVID-19. As businesses have flexed open, we have seen more travel on our system. But we're still looking at overall reductions in the number of miles we traveled, and that translates to reductions in both turnpike revenue as well as road toll or highway revenue. So we will ask Department of Safety speak to the highway fund specifically, but we have been advocating very strongly at the federal level for some assistance for highway divisions and DOTs across the country. We were very fortunate in the CARES Act. There was assistance provided to both airports and to public transportation or transit agencies. But up until now, there's been no relief for lost revenue on the highway network. So that's why we've had to identify some of these items that could be eliminated from the budget or deferred to future years. I want to first of all thank the governor and the legislature for the support during the last budget. We were very pleased with some of the items that were funded. But to help us both last money this year and tighten our belt, we had to defer some of those purchases or that work. And then because of the financial outlook, we have continued to minimize effort in a number of areas so that we could be financially constrained moving forward. This does leave the department with a couple of challenges that we'll be facing into the future. We are still very optimistic that something will happen at the federal level. There's been a lot of discussion about the need for a recovery bill that would lead to job creation, and certainly we would welcome the dollars to invest in the infrastructure. But we also need some relief in the form of backstop to cover operating expenses. Typically, we cannot use federal highway funds for operating maintenance systems. So that's why we've been asking for that specifically. The other item, as Marie mentioned, the FAST Act, our current federal authorization, was scheduled to sunset in September at the end of the federal fiscal year. Congress did pass a one-year extension, but it remains to be seen if we work with the new Congress and administration how much funding will be available for the future. We're still optimistic that by the end of next federal year, we'll have a 5 or 6 year federal authorization bill and understand what funding will be available for us to program the next 10-year plan. So our biggest concern remains the condition of our fleet. Many of you are familiar with this situation because we have testified on it several times. Again, we're extremely appreciative of the support that we got in the last budget, both capital dollars through AC25 to address the backlog of vehicles that were scheduled for replacement, as well as the increases that we saw in our operating budget to stay current and make sure that we're replacing vehicles at the appropriate time. The downside, what we're facing right now, is timing is such that while we have placed orders for new vehicles or we're in the process of building new trucks, not all of them are on the road yet. And so as we go into this winter season, we're still dealing with the older fleet and some of the breakdown challenges. While in parallel, we're doing everything we can to get the new trucks here and fit it out so they can be deployed.
So at this point, I'm going to ask Chris to just update you on the status of our procurement, because you know, we didn't really value the support that we received in the last budget. We want to make sure we update you on how the jello is being spent.
So good afternoon. For the record, Chris Walsh, Deputy Commissioner, and thank you for the opportunity to send this information. And first, I'd like to thank Marie Mullen, the director, who her and her staff really did a yeoman's work to put this budget book together. And I think this provides a good picture of what the department does. As we're not certainly going to spend a lot of time going through all the information, but the accomplishments that each of the accounting units are responsible for and what they have been able to accomplish with the funding that's provided. As we talk about the equipment, I want to just refer to page 79 of the book. I think this is a document that we have presented in the past. It really provides statistics on the condition of our fleet. So as usually once a year, we ask our materials and services administrator to put this together for us. So this is a status of the number of pieces of equipment, the different types of equipment, the expected age. That's our criteria that we use. You know, some of this heavy equipment we expect to last 12, 15 years. The mileage or hours usage that we use as the criteria when it's gone beyond useful life. And then the value, the purchase value, the approximate replacement value. My point here is,
just take 1 second, Chris.
Connected.
Thank you.
And it talks about the parameters, you know, what percentage of equipment sees the parameters, and then replacement cost. So you go down through this, our backlog at the end of the fiscal year in July, end of June, was $33 million. And as Commissioner noted, we have roughly $16 million of previously funded equipment purchases that are ready to be placed in service. They should be placed in service over the next several months. So the backlog is greatly reduced to about $17 million. So once these pieces of equipment are put in service, then we'll still have that backlog of $17 million. The concern that we have in terms of the budget is during the last budget cycle, we did fund equipment to a level that would need to maintain a certain condition of the fleet. So in essence, the backlog did not grow. In order to meet the target, we reduced that by $6 million each year. So instead of the $8.9 million, we have funded equipment at about the $2.9 million level. So that is one of our additional needs that we identified in the budget. The next area that we want to make the committee aware of is winter maintenance has been funded at a below three-year average level for the last several millenniums. We funded that fiscal year 21 modified adjustment level, and this level is approximately $6 million lower than what the three-year average has shown is needed. In each of the last 4 years, the department has had to seek transfers averaging $9 million from the highway surplus to the fiscal committee in order to fund winter maintenance. And I refer you to page 80, which just shows, again, the dollar values in the winter maintenance account, the different dollar values. We had a light winter in 2016, 2017 through 2020. Yeah, pretty significant winters that really exceed the three-year average, and we are about $6 million lower than that three-year average going forward in this budget.
So I would say that while this is still a need, it always remains to be seen how severe the winter will be and how much Mother Nature will test us. And so given the constraints, we still believe it's appropriate to reduce the value of this line item in the budget and then go through that fiscal process. That should we have a winter that warrants a transfer, then we would come forward. Last year, we just asked for a larger transfer, anticipating the weather to stay at the same frequency of storm events, but that did not materialize when we did last month. And so while we often come to this and take money out of the surplus, we then left it back in should we not have the winter weather and expend those dollars. So this is always a concern, but we certainly wouldn't want to increase the funding here at the expense of other critical funding to the department. And the other thing I always like to point out is when we talk about winter maintenance, we're talking only about the overtime, the cost of the material, and what we pay our hire trucks. It's not the true cost of winter. The straight time, you know, all of our dedicated employees, their regular salaries and benefits are programmed in the other parts of the budget.
A few other items I want to point out. This budget department did not request any new positions. However, we do want to make the committee aware that we've had several major capital projects completed, such as the Spalding Turnpike widening and I-93, since Manchester section, where we've added lane miles. So those costs to maintain those sections continue to increase, and we have absorbed those costs in the overall budget. We talked a little bit about preventive maintenance being cut in this budget, and I just want to point out the importance of preventive maintenance in terms of, you know, bridge washing and sealing, extending the life of bridges over time, some tree clearing, mowing, brush clearing, pushing back that to allow some light to be able to hit the road and reduce the salt usage. Those are some examples of things that this budget does not include. The other thing that we also wanted to point out, the department still has a significant shortage of rented equipment, particularly in the southeastern part of the state, whereas that rented equipment, which I believe about 50 to 55% of the department's winter maintenance activity is performed by hired contractors. There's been a shortage because of the rates that are paid. Massachusetts rates are nearly 75-80% higher than New Hampshire's rates, and it's very difficult in the southern part of the state to compete with that. So we continue to struggle with in that area, and there is some concern about being able to provide time and trim the road in that portion of the state because of this shortage. And this budget does not include any additional funding for any rate increase for that aspect.
The last item we have not included an additional need, but we wanted to flag it. Again, many of you are familiar with this issue, but we do not use a hard cash match to access our federal highway dollars, which means that the size of our program is smaller than our neighboring states, so they're actually adding 20% cash match to supplement those federal dollars. We in New Hampshire invest heavily in our turnpike. That means we earn what's called toll credit, and we use that non-cash match to access federal funds. We bring this up today because one of the proposals that's going through Congress right now is that instead of providing a cash backstop for lost highway revenue, they would just change the federal participation to 100%. For most states, because they use cash match to access that would free up, you know, that 20% to invest in their operating budget. New Hampshire would not benefit from that, so we have been trying to express that concern because we're already leveraging the federal program at 100%, bringing forth the toll credit that have a cash value. So that is something that we've brought to the attention of our congressional delegation. Out of all of the different options available to Congress to assist state DOTs, this is one that's attractive to them, but unfortunately would not benefit states like New Hampshire where we use toll credit. So we thought it was important to point that out, especially for the governor's office. So in total, to address all of our additional needs that are outlined, the department has identified $20.9 million in 22 and $22.3 million in 23. But again, that does include the additional need for winter, which may or may not transpire depending on the severity of the season. Lastly, we included some of our efficiencies. As a department, we are always looking for ways to do business better. We have a number of our employees who benefited from the lean training that the state offers, and so we do a lot of process reviews, and we're an agency that's embraced the balanced scorecards, have evolved that into a performance dashboard. So we have been working on a number of fronts. One of our key focus areas has been around asset management, making sure that we are collecting data for all of the assets that we own, so we know what we have, what condition it's in, what we need to do to it, and so that when we come before the legislature, we can help you understand how different investments in different areas are going to have either a change in the level of service or improvement in the overall condition. So we've been implementing a lot of software solutions that help us do that effectively and efficiently versus a more manual process, and the folks expect in the 21st century for us to have real-time data and information. That's not always the case, and so we can't be as nimble and as efficient as we'd like to be. So we've been investing in that area. Our big project this year is the deployment of our work order fleet and inventory system, which was funded through the prior capital budget. And so we're hoping that will bring significant improvements, as well as some additional transparency to the work of the department. Chris mentioned how we've expanded some of our highways, but we haven't necessarily increased our headcount or our equipment. To maintain those new pieces of infrastructure effectively, we are embracing the latest technology solutions, whether that's AVL systems help us track equipment and how much material is being put down, to systems that allow us to minimize our material usage, which is both good for the environment and saves us money. So we're doing a lot of work in that area. And then we have been looking at other processes that are more customer-focused. For example, our driveway permitting process and ways that we can streamline and make that more efficient so that we can be more productive with the staffing that we have. So hopefully this gives you a sense of what's in our budget and what our struggles might be, and we'd be happy to take your questions at this time.
Thank you, Commissioner. The highway fund, as well documented, woes in the past, and the COVID pandemic has only accelerated a reduction in vehicle miles traveled, and in putting together the targets for the major agencies that draw on the highway fund, the Department of State, the Department of Transportation, the Governor's Office work collaboratively. So I thank you all for your work in putting together a budget that is realistic given the revenue situation for the highway fund the state finds itself in. And while we've talked about some of the additional needs and how important they are, the fact of the matter is, given the financial resources, you put together a budget that if you all you got was your efficiency budget, roads would be maintained, the bridges would be safe, and we may not be doing the preventative maintenance that we all know we need to do, but we'll still maintain our vehicle transportation network to a standard that our citizens expect. But with that said, we invest heavily in our capital assets and have to lose the state to continue to maintain those assets so that we're not building additional costs down. So that's more of a statement than a comment, but thank you for your work. I'll open to questions. Representative Weiler.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. I'm impressed with how well our roads are compared with many other states. And I'm looking at page 41, the materials research. We have 51 people working there and have for many years. And I'm wondering, what's the result of all this research? Have we extended the life of pavements? Have we made them safer? Are they easier to clean? Or what's the result of spending all this money on research?
So it's not 51 supporting only research. It's materials and research. So that bureau is responsible for doing all of the assessments when it comes to the condition of our pavements. So our pavement section is part of that bureau. We also have a team of people who are testing all of the construction materials to make sure that we're getting the quality that we're looking for. And that is a requirement by Federal Highway as part of the quality assurance program. And then in addition, we do have personnel who are involved in research and we have seen tremendous benefits. We come before the Capital Budget Overview Committee to be able to use toll credits to access the federal SDR program, which is the research program. And a lot of the research that we perform is funded with federal dollars. And I'd be happy to share with you the report that we have on some of the savings as a result of the research that we have undertaken.
So we have been able to extend the life of pavement another year or two more than
we were 10 years ago. So we have that report, and I'd be happy to share it with you so you understand the positive outcomes that we've seen from the research.
Thank you,
Commissioner and Deputy Commissioner. I would also be interested in that report. But I will ask a question on page 79, and this is relative to the maintenance conversation that we've already jumped into. I'm looking at the bottom leftmost portion of page 79, which breaks out the necessary expenditures to catch up over time. These don't appear to be weighted either for the time value of money or for additional maintenance that might come up between, say, year 10 and year 15, right? That is somewhat of a moving target.
You would be assuming that you would have adequate funding in the operating budget to stay current and that you're just addressing the backlog of those figures.
Thank you.
On the turnpike side, obviously the turnpike is an enterprise, and we manage it just differently than anything else within the state. So obviously the operations of the department, as well as the costs, control of the turnpike, the department safety budget. Can you talk just very briefly about the impact of reductions in vehicle miles traveled on future capital projects from the turnpike? Because we cash flow, so the revenue loss impacts the timing of projects.
So we recognize that the capital projects are particularly important to the citizens of the state and to our stakeholders. And we also want to have a similar level of service across our entire network. And so the turnpike is an enterprise. In other words, we pay our debt, we pay our operations, we pay our maintenance first. Then we have to do what's called rehab and renewal work, where we keep everything in a good state of repair. And you only build new when you have the financial resources to do so. So if we were to maintain the status quo and fund all of those other operations and maintenance areas, then our capital program would be even further delayed. And so we have made reductions in other areas of the budget so that we have softened the impact across every area versus just having the capital program suffer because of the reduction in revenue. But we are looking at some significant delays potentially to those capital projects. It's challenging at this time to understand what the long-term ramifications of COVID-19 are going to be. Our turnpike roadways are our divided highways, and we're serving a lot of the commuting population. That's where we're not seeing the vehicle miles traveled rebound. So folks are enjoying, in some cases, the flexibilities of telework. I think even post-COVID-19, be able to attract and retain talent, and certainly it's going to be to New Hampshire's benefit. People can live in New Hampshire and work elsewhere and not have to commute daily, and that improves their quality of life significantly. So we are looking at, in the near term, what's happening with BMT, but then starting to look at other parts of the country and try and understand what the long-term impact might be on the turnpike system. Over the course of summer, the peak of the pandemic, like I said, when the governor implemented his stay-at-home order, we saw a significant reduction in traffic. That was a good thing, like I said earlier. That means people were listening. And our traffic volumes dropped by about 55%. As things flexed back open, and we had a very good summer, it was a dry summer. It was great to see so many people getting outside and enjoying what New Hampshire has to offer. We saw the DMT keep climbing, and we were really pleased to see the traffic rebound. However, since foliage season has ended and there's not quite so many visitors coming into the state, we're still now seeing about a 17% reduction in traffic on the system. So that's going to be our biggest area of concern. Statewide, traffic volumes have rebounded, but
on those corridors that carry a lot of commuting traffic. In certain plazas like Hoopston and Bedford, we've seen a reduction in traffic because those are the corridors we see a lot of movement up and down in Massachusetts. So that is our hardest revenue source forecast. And we're working very closely with our peers across the country who run their Turnpike systems, following what the rating agencies are saying in this area, so that we can continue to update our revenue forecast and work with both the governor's office as well as Ways and Means to keep you apprised of the changes.
And I'd like to add, we do have a reputable consulting firm that reviews our traffic and revenue. And we've had this firm do this work for the last half dozen years when we went for bond issuances. So they're nationally recognized, and they're going to be updating the traffic model and the revenue model for the next 10 years. And that's due probably after the first of the year. So that will give us a better indication on what the long-term outlook is from a very professional
standpoint. Thank you, Chris. Just make sure to put that in.
And I just say it's challenging until you know, we have a vaccine and we understand what the new normal is going to look like. It's just hard for us to predict how behavior will change, especially if it comes to commuting.
Any additional questions from the folks on the phone?
If you have a question, please pass. I have a question.
If they have a question, I have a first of all, Chris, I appreciate you recognizing Marie, and this is an impressive amount of material and information, and it's really terrific. I have a question, though, about fleet and managing it. There was some discussion a few years back when we had, I suppose we probably still have, the VW settlement, about using that to support the legitimate needs of the state instead of some new fangled goofy stuff. And did any of that money find its way into fleet?
Yes.
A significant amount, or did it get diverted?
I believe a little more than $4 million.
Was that it? Wasn't there talk at one point about $20 million coming?
Oh, well, up to $4 million came to the Department of Transportation. I believe over $29 or $30 million came to the state.
So, but only four of it saw its way into vehicles? Or, you know,
for the DOT, yes.
Is there any, does anyone know if there's any of that left?
I believe there is, but I'm not exactly sure. I mean, it was proportioned out in terms of what was assigned, state agencies, municipalities, what would be competitively procured. I'm not sure, you know, competitively solicited, and I'm not sure that they got to that phase as of yet.
But you have additional, like if there were money left,
oh,
additional vehicles we could use it for.
Absolutely.
Okay. We should look into that.
I was going to say, because it was a requirement, there is a trustee who oversees the VW settlement, and I'm sure it's the Office of Strategic Initiatives to provide a more detailed update. We had to submit a plan as to how we plan, how we're going to allocate the VW settlement. There was a certain amount designated for the replacement of state vehicles, and that actually did move forward very quickly. We were the first agency to benefit because we understood, you know, what trucks were going to be eligible for replacement under this program. And there wasn't a need to do a competitive procurement like there is with some of the municipal categories and such. We were the first recipients, and we were very appreciative of that. And we worked very closely with both CES and OSI.
And Commissioner Harlinghouse, I would say the DOT is probably the bulk of the money that has moved from that settlement at this point.
But do you have a sense that more available?
There's certainly our unallocated funds. You know, we budgeted the maximum for electric vehicles, the full 15% that was allowed in the trust. Those conversations are still ongoing. There's also, of course, a generous administrative component to that budget. We expect to be far under plan if those dollars be reallocated. It is a 10-year settlement, so we do still have some time to identify the best opportunities, best uses for those funds.
It feels like, and I mean, I'll just say this, but it feels like there are, the state has very sort of legitimate pre-existing needs that aren't funded, this is an obvious one, right? In this category, obviously, that, you know, nobody doubts that your vehicles are kind of a mess and could stand replacement.
The vehicles are not a mess. We're talking about a long-term replacement. We don't want to give the impression that state vehicles are not safe. They're safe.
Well, I didn't mean they were safe. I'm just saying they could stand being replaced. Let's just go with that. But it's a pre-existing need that we know is legitimate, as opposed to, I worry sometimes when you said, like, take a settlement from somebody goes, hey, I got this new idea, and, you know, we can't pay for the stuff we already got. We should not pay for new stuff. And if we can somehow figure a way to divert the money toward good stuff instead of, you know, goofy things.
I would completely agree, and I look forward to having this conversation, I think, tomorrow with OSI, perhaps on Monday.
Oh, good idea.
But between now and then, it's the beneficiary mitigation plan. That would be a good place to start, and also I can ask OSI to provide that part of the presentation.
We'll grill Jared.
I look forward to it.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
We'll now call our final presentation of the day, the Department of State. Only 30 minutes.
Good afternoon. My name is Robert Quinn, the Commissioner of the Department of Safety. I'm joined by
Steve LeBoyne, Director of Transportation.
Also, I'd like to introduce a new member of our team, Jocelyn Sai Santiago, who's seated in the back, and she's a key member of the team as well. May I begin? Well, thank you. Well, good afternoon, committee members. I appreciate your time. I also want to start by thanking the legislature and the governor's office for prior funding to the Department of Safety. As you know, our vision is to make New Hampshire the safest state in the nation with the highest quality of life for all. And the mission of the men and women of the 7th Division is to continually enhance the safety, security, and quality of life in New Hampshire through professional, collaborative, and innovative service to all. And that is our main goal. Our fiscal year 22-23 agency budget efficiency requests funds all existing funded positions within the department to ensure that we have the personnel necessary to carry out our mission. 23 previously unfunded New Hampshire State Police positions continue to remain unfunded. However, our efficiency budget does not include all the resources that our employees need to fully execute their duties. In addition to increases in salaries and benefits, the overall cost of doing business continues to rise, and several required costs being presented as additional prioritized needs. Throughout our presentation, we will identify those key items that remain an additional prioritized need, but are truly requirements to provide the same level of service to the people of New Hampshire. These include, but are not limited to, replacement cruisers for New Hampshire State Police Troopers, overtime, some key positions, facility maintenance costs, additional part-time staff. Funding these key items will ensure that the Department of Safety can protect the lives and safety of the New Hampshire citizens and businesses of our state throughout the next biennium. Before I turn it over to Director LeBoyne, who will give a high-level kind of overview of some of the key changes through the 7 divisions, I just want to say that the Department has kept customer service a priority through COVID. We continue to monitor customer service. We continue to use performance measurement metrics, a basis, a balanced scorecard, and continue to deliver what I say is excellent service. And I believe we've learned some new innovative ways to continue to enhance customer service through the COVID pandemic. With that, I know your time is very valuable. I'd like to turn it over to Steve LaVoy, who's got a presentation which addresses some of the challenges in the 7 divisions as well as the Office of the Commissioner. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. So the presentation will go through really look at our department from a division standpoint. On page 2, you'll see the department safety is funded through various funding sources. Part of that has to do with the uniqueness of each division's public safety mission and it being supported by different funding. So looking at it as a whole doesn't provide a meaning of looking at it division by division. But in summation, for the department safety for FY22, the department is requesting $205.3 million, and in 2023, $212.6 million. That does represent a 6% increase from 2021. The vast majority of that increase, as you'll see throughout, has to do with salary benefits. We're a people-driven organization, public safety, service delivery is a people-driven service. 65% of our costs department-wide are related to personnel. The remaining operating costs, a large portion of those also have to do with taxes, funding, federal funding that's sent to local and other state agencies across the state. There have been a few changes also in funding that we're forced to consider and move forward with given the weaknesses in general and highway fund revenue. And so those we'll touch on those so that we're clear on where those pieces are. If you move to page 3, first division that we'll speak to is Division of State Police. As a state law enforcement agency, looking at the state police patrol, the highways, road tolls, the toll roads, and interstates, and they enforce state criminal motor vehicle and other public safety laws. They operate 7 troop stations. They have a marine patrol facility, so they have very visible law enforcement presence across the state. And in addition to those services, they're also responsible for the state forensics lab, the criminal records unit, the permits and licensing unit, and all the security at the state house and as well as the Hampshire Hospital campus. Throughout each page, you'll see there's some service highlights for each division. We often provide FY19 data only because FY20, the impact that COVID had wasn't really reflective of what the budget would support in 22.3. So there's some data along the way. So for example, state police in 19 saw over 130,000 motor vehicles, arrested 1,206 impaired drivers, and conducted over 8,000 criminal investigations. The Division of State Police is funded by a mix of federal, turnpike, highway, general, and other funds. Those other funds include criminal records revenue, watercraft safety for voter registration, outside details from Hampshire Hospital Security Fund from HHS, and the increase from FY21 to FY22 $11.3 million for a request of $96.7 million. That increase is primarily made up of wages and related to increments, employee increments, as well as increased cost of benefits. There are 2 new federally funded positions that are included in there, like 2 Marine Patrol officers that are funded from the Coast Guard grant. We also have increases in operating costs due to some of the shifting that occurred in our budgeting in FY22-23. So some DOIP operating costs have been allocated to the Department of, the Division of State Police, to pertain to State Police, where originally they were being paid for out of the Department of Division of Administration. We also shifted retiree health benefits, which were being paid centrally in one area, down to each accounting unit, to make sure that we're charging the appropriate funding sources there moving forward. And then we also have overall increased operating costs that just come with delivering law enforcement services at a statewide level. And those include things like replacement cruisers, increased training, and also services related to utilities. One change in funding that's important to highlight is that we did replace nearly $2 million in general fund with 911 funds to support the state police communications function. And again, that was due to weaknesses in general, highway, and turnpike funds, and the need to make sure that dispatch services are able to continue at a statewide level. If you move to page 4, we do have some prioritized needs for the Division of State Police, the biggest being replacement cruisers. Our defined, we have a vehicle replacement plan, which is in place, and replace all of our vehicles in alignment with that plan. The goal is to replace vehicles prior to or around 150,000 miles. Safely cruisers, as you, I'm sure you understand, they're not driven like a normal vehicle. It's a vehicle that you and I drive. There's a lot of quick starts and stops that occur, more wear and tear, and the safety of our troopers, as well as the public, is important. As we continue to age those vehicles out at 150,000 miles, they'll increase the fare cost, which you'd expect at those higher mileage rates. So we're not keeping up the pace with our existing replacement plan. This additional funding would help us to get closer to that pace. The other area that we're always looking for additional funding is really in the Detective Bureau overtime. This is an area that's really hard to predict. Because the Detective Bureau is responsible for responding to homicides and major crime cases across the state, and we don't know what the volume of those will look like on a year-to-year basis. But based on recent history, we are receiving additional funding to make sure that we're able to respond at the same level that we have in the recent past. Page 5 is the next division, the Division of Motor Vehicles. The Division of Motor Vehicles is responsible for ensuring that all drivers and vehicle service providers are properly credentialed. And they're focused on providing efficient and effective customer service in the area of licensing, motor vehicles, and all motor vehicle related areas of matter. In FY19, the DMV issued over 333,000 titles. They performed over 27,000 field to road tests. And they produced over 357,000 driver licenses and ID cards. The DMV budget request for FY22 is actually a decrease from FY21 of $1.3 million, 4.6% decline. FY23 increases by $1.1 million, the 4% increase. The increase in FY23 has to do with employee increments and increased benefit costs, as well as some additional DOIT expenses. Additional prioritized need for the Division of Motor Vehicles is really two areas. One is the Ignition Feature Lock program that is currently being operated. It's requesting a new full-time program assistant to manage that program. When it was initiated in 2013, there were 300 participants. There's now 2,000 individuals in the state who are operating with an Ignition Feature Lock due to a DWI-related hearing order. And so making sure we have a full-time person in that position is critical. We also need additional funding for facility maintenance and renovation. That's to ensure that we continue to provide uninterrupted services at the DMV locations across the state to all of our customers. Page 6 is the Division of Fire Standards and Training and Emergency Medical Services, which is committed to the training and education of community responders to protect citizens and visitors in New Hampshire. The demographics covered include firefighters, EMS providers, public works members, and citizen volunteers. Request for FY22 is a $209,000 decline from FY21, so that's a 2% drop. That has to do with decreases in operating costs associated with delivery of existing training programs. And then we have a slight increase, a 1% increase in FY23 at $8.5 million, and that has to do with increases in salary benefits for the employees. The fire standards training and EMS division enrolled over 15,000 students in FY19. They issued 1,500 certifications, and they licensed over 5,000 EMS providers. This area is funded by a mix of fire funds, other funds and federal funds, and the other funds are actually instruction fees that are collected from local fire departments who are sending their folks through for certification to be full-time firefighter and safe in the future. Page 7 is the Division of Fire Safety. The Division of Fire Safety is where the fire marshal's office resides, and the division is responsible for preventing death, injury, and property loss by promoting safe fire building and hazardous material environment for citizens and visitors in New Hampshire. And they do this through education, engineering, investigation, and enforcement. In FY19, the division investigated 206 fire-related incidents and conducted conducted 555 fire and life safety inspections. The FY 2022 request is $5.3 million, which is $66,000 more than FY 21, so 1% increase, an $86,000 increase into the 2023 request of $5.4 million. That's a 2% increase from 22. That increase is due to salary benefit increases. One of the changes that you'll see here from the fund mix, fire marshal's office in the previous biennium received additional general funds. Because of the weaknesses within the general fund in the current biennium, we were unable to continue to fund the fire marshal with those funds and have to move the fire marshal 100% back onto the fire fund. In the previous biennium, we worked closely with the governor's office and the legislature to try and find a solution for the fact that both Division of Fire Safety and the Division of Fire Standards and Training draw on fire funds, which cannot sustain both of those divisions at a full capacity level. So the idea was to shift a portion of the fire marshal to the general fund long term. Unfortunately, we're not able to do that through this current budget process. We are able to sustain this level of funding in FY 22 and 23. However, the following biennium will not be able to sustain both divisions. The one additional prioritized need we have for the Division of Fire Safety is additional part-time funding for building inspectors, primarily to support building fire and life safety inspections and plan reviews for state buildings. The fire marshal is responsible to perform that work. It's not only state agencies, as in DOT, Department of Safety, Administrative Services, but it's also the university system. The university system has a lot of construction, and the fire marshal is responsible for playing a role there. Unfortunately, right now, they don't have the resources to really provide the service that people are expecting. So that's an area that would help. It's also funding to help public education and hazardous materials position. It has a secure response position across the state. The next page 8, is the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, which is responsible for coordinating campus response to major urban factors. HSCM activates the State Emergency Operations Center and really coordinates all the resources that we have in the state whenever there is a disaster. Most recently, HSCM has been acting in that capacity with our response to COVID-19. In 2019, they activated the State Emergency Operations Center 7 times, and they facilitate exercises and trainings across the state for emergency preparedness and response. There's 46 exercises and 65 trainings conducted. The budget request for FY22 is an increase of $6.8 million up to 17.2, but you'll notice that increase is federal money. That's all federal disaster money that we're expecting to receive and spend through the next year related to existing disasters, including COVID-19, and that some of that is reimbursing the state itself, and some of it is passed on to local. Aside from that, there really aren't any significant changes in the HSCM request. Page 9 is the Division of Emergency Services and Communications, which oversees the state 911 system. And so the Division staff two public safety answering point call centers, one is in Concord and one is in Laconia. Those are geo-redundant, so if one fails, the calls are automatically being answered by the other. In fact, they can be answered by both at the same time. Their request for the Division of Emergency Services and Communications for FY22 is a 2% increase of $16.5 million, and then a 4% increase in 23 of $17.3 million. Those two salary and benefits, and then also some additional service costs associated with the new T25 LMR system project that was put into place and operational last year. Additional prioritized need here is part-time assistance. So we find that there's telecommunicators who, for whatever reason, are unable to maintain a full-time schedule. This is a demanding job, but they have a lot of experience and can help with coverage issues, and we have people that are out due to sickness or any belief, and so this additional funding will allow us to leverage that and ensure that the phone continues to be picked up whenever there's a call for an emergency. Next is the Office of the Commissioner, which is obviously responsible for overseeing the Department of Safety as a whole. It headed by a commissioner and two assistant commissioners. All the divisions report directly there to the office of the commissioner. There are a few key functions that report directly to the commissioner's office, including the legal unit, the Bureau of Hearings, and the public information officer. The request for 22-23 budget is a slight decline from 21 to $18.7 million, a 2% decline. And then 23 requests is a $904,000 increase, or a 5% increase to $19.675. The decrease is, as I mentioned before, is due to an allocation of retirement expense to the different areas where the employees originally resided to ensure that dedicated funds were paying the appropriate portions of those funds. And then the increase has to do with wages and benefit increase that are expected throughout the year. The Office of Highway Safety is also an area that has fallen under the Commissioner's office. This is an office that receives federal funding and disperses that money across the state to help with highway enforcement activities and also educational activities. There are two 100% federally funded positions. One of them is a highway safety field rep, and the other is an informational rep to both help distribute the funds and also to increase the public awareness and education message. As far as additional prioritized needs, Commissioner's Office is requesting a new attorney 3. This position would be designed specifically to report to the commissioner and oversee any investigations within the department, especially those in coordination with the Attorney General's office, make sure that we have the proper investigation process within our department and it's properly independent of the decisions that are being investigated. And then there's also some additional need for overtime in this area due to the public information officer and the need to respond to public safety incidents that often don't occur during normal business hours. And last but not least, we have the Division of Administration, the division I'm somewhat partial to. So the Division of Administration is really the internal service position for the Department of State. So we provide all of the revenue collection, expenditure reporting, human resources and payroll management, budgeting, grants, and asset management. The budget for the Division of Administration for 2022 is $11.5 million. This is a $3.9 million decline from the prior year. That decline has to do with shifting of costs, specifically DOIT costs, which were being paid for out of one central area, but again, being allocated to make sure that dedicated funds were paying their fair share throughout the department itself. As far as additional prioritized needs for administration, there's additional funding necessary for facility maintenance to ensure that we can continue to deliver uninterrupted services to our highway funded properties. So primarily our troop stations, as well as our warehouse and our automotive facility. There's also some requests for additional part-time funding to ensure that we've got the proper human resource support, and then also part-time funding to manage our internal procurement work order systems and improve our controls and efficiencies in those areas. That's really all that we have for a presentation at this point. We'll be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Steve. Excellent insight. Presentation on a large, complex department. One thing I'd like to go back to, and it's in the Division of State Police, there was a realignment. There were salary changes. I mean, that have impacted personnel budgets for state troopers, and that is the largest driving factor for the department's state-funded personnel costs. Is that correct?
That's correct. They're not fully. The impact of it is somewhat muted when you look at year over year because they go into effect starting in January of the existing fiscal year, and that increase is reflected in the 2021 adjusted authorized. But yes, that's a significant increase that impacted us.
Do members of the committee have questions for the department? If I can't believe this, you guys are going to get off the hook.
One thing. Since nobody's going to say anything, I think this is the appropriate time to say, because you brought up HSEM, that for a lot of people on the phone, and for most of the people in the room, we wouldn't be able to have this hearing without the very able of HSEM. And we want to make sure that they can thank you.
No, that's an excellent point that HSCM, more so than probably any other division in the state government, supports the state and the operations of state government during the pandemic in ways that I think many of us didn't realize we were going to have to do. So thank you to you all and your team for that. And thank you to the team who made this call today and tomorrow and then on Monday. That does bring up another point as far as the FEMA funds that we're expecting for reimbursement in HSCM. These are costs, so as far as the costs that the state would receive, or the funds the state would receive as part of the FEMA reimbursement, those, are you budgeting, just want to make sure that we're not budgeting assumed FEMA reimbursement in 22 and 23 for activity that's taking place in this biennium. Because again, we'd want those to be charges against, those would be federal receivables for now, not in 22 and 23.
Right, so these are the appropriations for expenditures associated with the disbursement. And so the vast majority of these would be once the disaster reimbursement has been approved by FEMA, the funds need to be dispersed to either the state or the local, and that's what these amounts represent.
So it's the cost of administrating the FEMA reimbursement, not the disbursement?
It's a combination of the two, because there are there will be disbursements that occur that we need to have the appropriation authority to expend when those decisions aren't going to be, that may not be made until later. FEMA tries very hard to make decisions timely, but that's also one of the big complaints that anyone dealing with a disaster has is that you may not be reimbursed for your disaster for several months, pushing a year. And so to ensure that we have the ability to make those disbursements and not have to seek additional funding appropriations to the fiscal, we include estimates for those amounts.
Thank you. Stephen, another excellent presentation. I don't know if it's going to last for by the time you get to the House. We'll be looking at things such as on page 3, you said you had a $1.7 million increase in the state police because they had been reduced from the commissioner's office, which is on page 10, but that turned it twice to a crosswalk. So if you can be prepared, you know where we are about the details in the crosswalk when you get to us, it'd be great.
Understood.
And again, thank you for the great presentation.
Thank you.
No one on the phone? So I think we have one phone question this entire day. Well, thank you to the Department of Safety and all of the departments that have come today. We will reconvene tomorrow at 8:30, starting with you. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.